minutes. Okay, well, I'd like to welcome everybody to the council meeting. Today is dedicated to Groundfish Amendment 16. Before I get started and make some remarks, I'd just like to note that Jim Balsiger is here from Silver Spring. He's the acting assistant administrator to National Marine Fisheries Service, seated to my right. Quick remarks concerning how we're going to handle the decisions today. We will, the decisions are grouped in a sequential order, and we will put motions on the board if there are preferred alternatives recommended to us by the committee. At that point, I will go to the audience and provide the audience an opportunity to comment on the preferred motion recommended by the committee or to provide comments or arguments for other options or alternatives on that decision. We'll then come back to the council and have a debate and a discussion at the council level and proceed to taking a vote. And we're going to do that issue by issue. I believe on the table outside is a copy of the motions that the committee has already gone through. There are over 50 decisions the council needs to make today. So staying on task, providing a fair opportunity for both sides to present their point of view, and then allowing the council to finally come to a resolution or a decision issue by issue is the only way we're going to get out of here. The only way we're going to make our decisions. For the most part, most of these options have been in the document for 18 months, at least a year. We've had ample public meetings, committee meetings, scoping meetings, public hearings, public comment period. Staff will present the findings of the public comment period, the recommendations of the advisory panel, issue by issue. So as we take up an issue such as allocation baseline, we'll have a motion from the committee. We'll go to the audience and take comment on that. We'll come back to the council. Staff will inform the council how the advisory panel viewed that decision. We'll get a report on how the committee reviewed that decision. We'll hear what the public comment was on that decision, and then the council will debate it. So that's the process we're going to use today. Remind everybody to turn off their cell phones or put them on silence, and also that I tend to take breaks about every 90 minutes. I will take breaks if we seem that we're in a position of confusion. People need to get up, stretch their legs, and have a conversation. Council members can ask for that as well. We will get through this, we'll make good decisions, and we're going to move on. So if there's any questions from the council, I'll entertain them now. Otherwise, I'll turn it over to Rip. Okay, Rip Cunningham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As usual, the materials for the groundfish actions are behind tab number 3, and that's if you can fit them all behind tab number 3. While there's a lot of important material for Amendment 16, today's discussion, the ones that will be most germane will be number one, which is the decision document for draft Amendment 16. Number seven, draft Amendment 16 and its DEIS. And one that has number 13 on it, but I was told by Rodney it's really number 12A. Because 13 is bad luck. And that's the ground fish committee motions. Since we have a lot of ground to cover, I don't have a specific ground fish committee report to make. I would like to take this opportunity to recognize that the stack of paper that we have in front of us is the product of a lot of work over the last 3 years. I personally want to thank all of the committee members who have put a lot of time into this, the members of both of the APs, the PDT members, and in particular Tom and Ann, who have done a substantial amount of work to bring this all together today. There certainly are a lot of members of the industry and organizations that have been extremely helpful to the process as well. It has not been an easy process, and I suspect that we will have some additional shuffling as the day goes on. Is it a perfect plan? Well, that's the rhetorical question of the day that I think we all know the answer to. But Amendment 16 moves us towards output controls or catch shares and toward management regimes that will do a better job for the resource and for the industries that use the resource. The chair has sort of already indicated, but I'll reiterate that as we move through the approval process today, we are going to do things a little bit differently than in the past. Our plan has been to take Amendment 16 in the fashion one eats an elephant, one chunk at a time. For each section, Tom will give a short presentation on the critical issues, and will summarize the public comments on that section, and then we will put motions on the table. We're going to use this process throughout the document, and we will be following the order that is in the Amendment 16 decision document, which is document number one. And as also indicated earlier, where we felt it would facilitate the process, we have grouped some motions together as one. On the ones that we know are more controversial, they will come as individual motions. With that, we will get the process started, and we will start out under the section 4.2, which is status determination criteria and revised rebuilding strategies. I'll turn it over to Tom first.
Thank you. This section of the amendment does a couple things. The first thing is the revised status determination the updates to the status determination criteria and the revisions to the status determination criteria. There are two options. One is no action, which would keep the overfishing definitions adopted by Amendment 13. It would not represent the best available science. The second option would revise the status determination criteria consistent with the results of GARM 3 and the Data Poor Working Group that was held, assuming that wolffish is later adopted into the management unit. In conjunction with those revisions to the status determination criteria, the second section of this revises the mortality targets for the formal rebuilding programs. Again, option one would be no action. Option two modifies the rebuilding fishing mortality targets to meet the new overfishing targets and also to take into account the information from GARM 3. This section also adopts formal rebuilding programs for several new stocks. I'd also like to highlight one thing in this section that came as a sort of a fallout from the TMGC meeting, which was held last spring. And if you look in section 4.2.2.2 in your amendment, revised rebuilding targets, in particular, towards the bottom, it talks about modifying. Hang on a sec. Let me find it exactly. This section includes language which allows the recalculation of the rebuilding mortality target as you get new scientific information in. If you recall, Amendment 13 had specific spots where we would adopt a new fishing mortality target, and this is one of them. This section includes language which, if you have an assessment that comes in and allows you to recalculate a new rebuilding F based on that assessment, assuming you have the ability to make the appropriate change. And it highlights that really the only stock where that's possible at this point is Georges Bank Yellowtail Flounder, where on the track we have an assessment every year, and conceivably we could recalculate the rebuilding F for that stock every year and base the Georges Bank Yellowtail Flounder hard tack on the results of that assessment every year. I think there are pluses and minuses to this approach. One plus is that allows you to adjust your rebuilding program consistent with your scientific information that you get every year. I think a minus of that approach is, as we all know, assessments fluctuate from year to year, and so there could be a tendency for that rebuilding F to jump around from one year to the next. So you could have, you know, your rebuilding F change every year, and that could conceivably cause some confusion. This at present is really the only stock where we would have the ability to do this approach, though conceivably if we got to output controls down the road, you could extend this approach to other stocks as well. What is not addressed in this particular section, because it was written before the SSC meeting, is how to deal with the SSC report and their recommendation on ABCs yesterday. It's not clear to me if the council wants to get into that issue now or wants to discuss that a little later. There was one comment from the Groundfish Advisory Panel on this section. They suggested that the council should send a letter to NIMS asking to extend the rebuilding period for southern New England mid-Atlantic winter flounder. If the rebuilding period cannot be extended, the AP went on to suggest to treat southern New England mid-Atlantic winter flounder in a manner similar to ocean pout and windowpane, which I think basically banning possession. That subject will come up several times later today.
There were no specific public comments on this section. So on behalf of the committee, I will move that the council adopt the following options for Amendment 16, Section 4.2.1 and 4.2.2. Section 4.2.1.2, Option 2, Revised Status Determination Criteria, that was voted at the committee 10-0. The Section 4.2.2, Option 2, Revised Mortality Targets for Rebuilding Programs, voted at the committee 9-0. And Pollock Rebuilding Period, Option 2, Rebuild by 2017, committee vote 9-4, 1 against, 0 abstaining.
Okay, we have a bundle of committee motions on the board. Before I go to the council, I'm going to go to the audience. Anyone in the audience wish to make comments on this motion? Just for people in the audience, my ability to see through these columns isn't refined. So if you're sitting behind a column and you can't see me, I probably can't see you. And if you want to make a comment, try to get up and put your hand up in the back so I can call on you. Anyone in the audience? All right, back to the council. Discussion. Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Rip, if you would, could you provide some insight as to the merits of Option 2 versus Option 1 for the Pollock rebuilding strategy? There's a 3-year difference in the options, and in light of the situation we're now facing with Pollock, that is the letter we received from the service regarding the situation with Pollock, why the 17 date instead of the 20 date?
I was just talking with Tom to refresh my memory. Yeah, there's very little difference in terms of the mortality on either the either of the rebuilding periods, and the SSC advice was to go with 2017.
I can't recall the specifics of the information given to us by the service relative to pollock, overfishing, overfish, but I've been told by members of my staff that, you know, pollock could not end up being a choke species in our management of the groundfish, the suite of species of groundfish. So I'm just looking for for a better understanding as to the implications of our having to hit the target in 17 as opposed to 20. If we don't know, fine enough, but if we do know, it would be helpful to understand those, appreciate those implications. Will we need those 3 extra years to get to the rebuilding target in light of the status of pollock right now?
Well, I don't know the difference between the F target between 2017 and 2020, but one of the real advantages of doing 2017 instead of 2020, in other words, using the 7 years instead of the 10 years, and this is an approach that the council has used in other species now, and we've also used in the Mid-Atlantic, is that it gives you something of a buffer. Right now, most of our management programs are based on the full 10-year requirements. So we've used all of the time that's available to us under the law to rebuild these stocks. And so when we get into a situation where we're not on track, it creates particular difficulties at the end of the program. You've basically got this balloon payment at the end of the program. So if you plan instead over a 7-year horizon instead of the 10-year horizon, you've provided yourselves a buffer at the end of it so that you can extend out to the 10 years when you find out that you're not on track. So it provides a lot more flexibility during the rebuilding program if you go with the 17 instead of the 20.
Anyone else on the council? Mark Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't see that we really have an option here relative to the status determination, but I will, for the record, again, express my concerns about the revised status methodology and the singular approach to dealing with the retrospective patterns, which in many ways dramatically changed, you know, some of the assessments. I think at a very narrow decision to use a singular correction method when alternative correction methods were available, and in fact were expressed in the text of the GARM report. Other factors could have caused those patterns. In my view, what should have been done is that multiple correction methodologies should have been explored, and those candidate models should have been evaluated. And if a clearer one didn't emerge, there could have been a model averaging procedure attempted. So I think it was a very narrow and a very bold decision to apply that singular correction methodology. But it is what it is. We don't have the legal, I think, opportunity to rely on stale stock status determination. So I'll support this with reservations.
Anyone else on the council? Pat Kirkle.
There was an issue in our letter to the council of June 10th under this section 4.2, having to do with some discussion in the document on pollock and whether or not it falls under one of the provisions of the Magnuson Act that would allow the council to consider only U.S. catches when they're looking at the pollock fishery. And I believe there was some discussion at the committee meeting, but no motion was made to, in fact, revise the language in the document to indicate that no determination has been made under this section of the Magnuson Act to indicate that the exemption could be applied, which would require the Secretary of Commerce to make a finding that there was excessive international fishing pressure on the stock. And so I just want to make sure that section of the document is clarified, and I can make that in a form of the motion if the chair wishes. But I know that the committee did discuss it at least.
Let me see if I understand. So, as written right now, the document is suggesting that we're going to seek and receive an exemption?
It doesn't really say we're seeking one. It's basically claims one, which the service has told us we really can't because, unfortunately, I'm not the secretary. So.
Pat, okay. Why don't you make a motion?
Motion to amend. I'd like to move to strike the language in section 4.2.2.2.1 concerning international fishing for pollock.
Is there a second? Seconded by Sally McGee. Discussion on the motion to amend? Jim Otten.
I don't have it right in front of me, but Tom maybe can tell us what's the amount of. I thought it was pretty minor, the pollock, Canadian pollock catch.
Yeah, what the amendment document says is that the Canadian pollock catch has been about 14%. It's actually in the last 2 years been much lower than that. It's been on the order of 5 to 6%, I think, for the management unit that we're assessing. This change makes a relatively minor difference, and quite honestly, it tends to be down in the noise of how much of a reduction is needed at present. I forget the exact numbers, but it makes a change of about 2 or 3% in the total reduction that's needed from the stock.
Anything further from the council on the motion to amend? You ready for the question? All those in favor on the motion to amend, raise your hand. Unanimous. Back on the main motion as amended. Anything further from the council? On the main motion as amended. Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Unanimous on the main motion as amended. Rip.
We will move on to Section 4.3.1, which is the annual catch limit section. Tom, do you have some comments on that?
There are two options in this particular section. One is no action, which is that the council would not adopt any system for annual catch limits. Clearly, this would not comply with the requires of the Magnuson-Stevens Act. Second option adopts annual catch limits for the multi-species fishery. It goes into quite a bit of detail. Adopting this option includes adopting all the elements of the option. It includes the definition of subcomponents or sub-ACLs in a number of instances. Some of those subcomponents or sub-ACLs could change depending on some of the decisions that may be made later today. In addition, that particular block in the amendment doesn't show that there will be an ACL for Atlantic wolffish, but one of the council's later decisions is to incorporate or not Atlantic wolffish into the management unit, in which case it would be added to the list of stocks where there is an ACL. I want to make it clear that there was some misunderstanding in a couple circles that the suggestion that if you read the rebuilding mortality targets, There are a couple species where we cannot actually calculate rebuilding mortality targets. And some people interpreted that as saying that we wouldn't set an ABC or an ACL for those stocks. Obviously, from the SSG chair's report yesterday, we will be setting an ABC and an ACL for all of the stocks, and they've come up with methods to do that or suggested ways to do that in the case of those stocks where we can't do a projection. This section also describes the process for setting ACLs. There's no real numbers saying what the ACL will be next year. Just so everyone understands, the intent is that later this summer and fall, the council will prepare a document that's submitted to the service that gives our recommendations for annual catch limits based on ABCs that the SSC will recommend in early August. The intent right now is to submit that document as a specification package accompanied by an environmental assessment. I guess it's at least theoretically possible that the council could choose to submit that some other way, but frankly, I'm not sure there would really be time to do that. So it's likely that it will be a specs package.
Yeah. Okay, for public comments on ACLs, I'm going to say just really briefly how I'm going to go over the public comments since this is the first one. Okay. Just a little bit about the public comments we received on Amendment 16 in general. We got in the ballpark of 10,000 comments on the amendment. The attendance at the public hearings was very light compared to Amendment 13 and other groundfish actions in the past. And I'm going to go just over sort of the tally of the comments on each item that there were a significant number of comments on, but some letters had multiple signatures or from organizations versus individuals, so it's really just a rough tally just to get an idea of what the public comment was. And for ACLs, if I can find the slide here, I have it on the same slide as AMs because that's how we did it before. We got roughly 78 comments on ACLs. There was general support for implementation. Concern that the numbers, the specific numbers for the ACLs wasn't available yet and that those numbers did not go out to public comment. And also, something interesting was that there seemed to be a lot of confusion in the letters that we received between what was an ACL, what was a TAC, what was a hard TAC. The terminology was sort of garbled in a lot of the letters. And you can see under the AM section, it says there were about 9,000 form letters that stated that the accountability measures had to be strong to ensure that fishing stops when ACLs are reached. Those letters also advocated for science-based ACLs, so that was really a lot of support for ACLs in the letters.
Okay, I will put up the motion. On behalf of the committee, I move that the council adopt section 4.3.1.2 annual catch limits, but that the submission date of the ACL action be revised from December 15 to December 1. That passed the committee 10-0.
Okay, I'm going to go to the audience before I go to the council. Anyone in the audience wish to comment on this motion? Good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gib Brogan with Oceana. We generally support the implementation of annual catch limits in this fishery and think that this is a good step forward. As we've said in the past, we think that the work that's been done so far is incomplete, that there are far more stocks that should be in this fishery. The groundfish fishery catches a tremendous number of species across the New England and Mid-Atlantic regions, and we were hopeful as this process began that the council would do a full analysis of what's being caught in this fishery and expand the list of stocks that are in this fishery. But as it stands right now, this is a good first step. We hope that in the future the list of fisheries will be expanded and we can get a real handle on the mortality that's going on. One issue that I've got with the motion as it stands and as it's put into the decision document is the discussion of the scallop fishery. And there's a clearly identified interaction between the scallop fishery and yellowtail flounder. And right now it's listed as, I guess, a subcomponent, that the scallop catch of yellowtail is a subcomponent, and that those measures, the accountability measures, will be developed in the future as part of Amendment 15 to the scallop FMP. That's not scheduled to go into effect until 2011. And the question is, what's going to happen to yellowtail catch in the scallop fishery between the implementation of this amendment and the implementation of the scallop amendment? And so there's a year of a gap in there. Right now, the scallop fishery is controlled. Their yellowtail catch is well controlled. But right as it stands right now, it sounds like it's going to be uncontrolled for a year there. And I'd like to just get some clarification and see what the status is of that. And if there isn't, if there aren't measures in place, I'd just like to urge this council to put something in place for that interim. Thanks.
Anyone else in the audience? Back to the council. Discussion from the council. Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Seventeen, unanimous.
We'll now move on to sector administration, section 4.3.3. And first we will take sector definition, formation of a sector, section 4.3.3.1. Tom?
In general, Amendment 16 completely revises the sector operating policies, sector administration provisions. This is a major part of the amendment. The amendment itself, Amendment 13, I think, had about a page or a page and a half on sectors, and this amendment has, you know, upwards of 10 or 15 pages describing sector operations. With respect to the particular motion that is will be coming up shortly, there are a number of changes with respect to the definition of what a sector is. We clarify that. We make it clear that sectors are voluntary and self-selecting. The definition is consistent with the council's sector policy that was adopted well over a year ago. We propose additional requirements for operations plans. There was some confusion about how operations plans are submitted and what needs to be in an operations plan. There's more detail in this amendment which describes that. There's also, at present, if you have a permit that is placed in a category called Confirmation of Permit History, or the CPH category, you have to activate that permit in order to put that permit into a sector, which in essence means you have to put it on some kind of vessel, and that triggers a bunch of other requirements. This proposal in here is to remove that requirement that would allow a CPH permit to be placed in a sector without being activated. There is one point that I'd like to highlight. I think there's a little bit of a lack of clarity in the second bullet on this provision, in this motion, the provision to modify the definition of a sector for a monkfish limited access permit to be allowed to join a groundfish sector. It's not clear to me as staff exactly what it is that the council is asking or the committee is suggesting that do. I don't know if that means that a permit that does not presently have a groundfish permit can join a sector and then land groundfish if the sector rules want it to. I think it would be helpful to have some discussion about exactly what it is that this provision does.
I believe also that we didn't have any AP comments on these sections.
The only thing I will highlight is that this advisory panel did raise the issue of participation of monkfish permits and some other fishery-type permits in groundfish sectors and recommended that the council address the question.
I'll go over the public comments that we got on sectors in general, since we're moving the sectors now. There was a lot of support for sectors from outside the fishery, including a lot of form letters and letters from NGOs. There was sort of a lukewarm response from the industry. There were a lot of individual comments about how sectors would work and stuff, so this is a really, really broad overview. We had at least 25 comments that said that the council should go straight to ITQ system and bypass sectors altogether. There were major concerns about the cost of formation and the cost of membership in sectors and about consolidation of permits that would occur with the move to sector management. A lot of comments that there wasn't enough information for people to decide whether to join a sector or not, and that the vote was premature before the information had gotten out. That includes people complaining about a faulty time frame for submitting the operations plans and getting information on ACL, since that information won't come out until September, and people have to decide whether to join sectors before that. And that was not just from industry, but also from NGOs making those kinds of statements. There were a lot of comments about sector interactions with other fisheries, including the continued use of DAS, of days at sea, when fishing for monkfish and other species, comments that sectors should expand to other fisheries, and a huge number of comments that sectors should be exempt from rolling closures, which I guess comes later, but it's under sectors in general.
Okay. On behalf of the committee, I move that the council adopt section 4.3.3.1, first, the revised definition of a sector, and option 2, permits in CPH categories do not need to be reactivated to join a sector. Pass the committee 9-1. Secondly, the provision be made in the definition of a sector for monkfish limited access permits to be allowed to join a groundfish sector as specified by the monkfish FMP or future council action, and may exempt vessels in a sector from multi-species days at sea reductions. Pass the committee 9-0. And thirdly, the council also adopts option 2 for additional sector operations plan requirements. Section 4.3.3.2.2, pass the committee 10-0.
Okay, I'm going to go to the audience on these three items in the motion. Maggie?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maggie Raymond, Associated Fisheries of Maine. In our comments on the DEIS, we did write in support of modifying the definition of a sector to allow monkfish limited access permits to join a sector. This is also a recommendation that will be coming from the Monkfish Committee tomorrow, as well as the Monkfish Advisory Panel. Our rationale for that was to the monkfish plan is in the process of potentially allowing sector allocations or ITQs, and we're hoping that will be able to happen in the timeline that's allotted for that amendment. However, it doesn't appear that there will be time to actually allow the formation of monkfish sectors in that plan. So we're hoping to be able to jumpstart the ability of us to be able to, if we get an allocation of monkfish in the monkfish FMP, to be able to utilize that in our groundfish sector. So we would urge the council to vote in support of this recommendation by the committee. Thank you.
Paul.
Paul Parker, Hook Fishermen's Association, Chatham, Mass. There are a couple of organizations, including Down East Maine and on the Vineyard, that are trying to put together sectors that would allow for access in the future. They're going to be coming up to talk about the possibility of allowing open access hand gear B permits to be enrolled in sectors if the ops plan of those sectors indicated that they wanted to have those people in their sector. And I would support that. I think it's a good idea, especially in those communities where there's very restricted access to fishing. I think it could be added through an amendment to this motion, and I think it would be benign to the impact of the amendment. Thank you very much.
Tom Osmers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hello, everybody. Tom Osmers from the fishing community on Martha's Vineyard Island. I just wanted to say a couple words that about the open access permit being in a member of a sector. The sector, of course, will be operating with a hard tack. I think it's one mechanism whereby we can let the young people in our community participate in the fishery. I was hopeful that that you guys could see that it's not a threat. I mean, an open access permit joining a sector, he'll be working with the allocation that goes with that sector. It's just one possible step in our continuing efforts to preserve fishing and the potential for the young people in the community to be part of our several hundred-year-old heritage there on the island. Thank you.
Ron.
Ron Smolowitz, Fishery Survival Fund, representing most of the limited access scallop fleet. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just some general questions regarding how the scallop fleet fits into this picture. Can the scallop fleet form a groundfish sector?
I think presently, without groundfish permits, they would not be allowed to form a sector under the groundfish plan.
But if, in fact, this starts incorporating monkfish limited access days at sea, and some scallop vessels have combination permits, some have limited access monkfish permits, plus if CPH permits are available and don't have to be placed on a vessel. I'm just wondering if, in fact, consideration has been given to the potential for scallop vessels to get into this sector concept for the purposes of acquiring bycatch.
I think your original question was, can limited access scallopers form a groundfish sector?
Right.
But if there were limited access scallopers with limited access monkfish permits, they could probably, under this motion, they could join a groundfish sector that was formed.
But they can't form one if they had a mix of groundfish vessels and scallop vessels. There's just right now there's the because I don't have the full text in front of me of the rules. To be in a sector, you have to have a vessel with an active groundfish permit, potentially a monkfish permit, or in addition a monkfish permit.
Okay. Right, and my read of the motion is that it's still bound to a future action, either in the monkfish plan or a future council action, to define that joining. The ability of a monkfish permit to join a groundfish sector. At least that's the way the motion reads.
Okay, thank you.
Gibb?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gib Brogan with Oceana. Generally, Oceana is supportive of the sector concept. We have real problems with the way that sectors are laid out in this amendment. We think it needs a lot more work and that there are a lot of loopholes in this that can be exploited in various ways. Every time I read through this, I think of a new way, a new weakness that's in this sector proposal, and I'm afraid that the council is going down a path with this amendment that they're going to wish you did. Editorializing. On specific to this motion here and the definition of a sector, there's been some discussion and some confusion about minimum sizes of sectors. And as it stands right now, and I've gotten confirmation of this from council staff, there is no minimum size for a sector. So a sector can be one operator, potentially, and the agency will have no grounds to reject a sector proposal from one operator who wants to have a sector that represents their own holdings. My concern on this one is that that gets very close to an ITQ, the way that I see it. That's an individual quota, and there are other provisions in this that allow for open transferability. My concern is that this is going to then trigger the referendum, and there are other elements of this amendment that need to go through to satisfy the Magnuson-Stevens Reauthorization Act and meet the deadline. And I'm afraid that if we get close to that ITQ threshold, council staff during some of the hearings said that we are skirting that threshold, I think was the term that was used at the Wakefield hearing, that as it's written right now. And I'm afraid that as we go closer and closer to that, if we get to that point, have a deadline in front of us, and then have to go through a referendum, that we're going to be in a world of hurt on this one. And so I think that sectors, unfortunately, there's been a lot of work done on this one, but I think that sectors need to be pulled off the table, and some of these loopholes need to be plugged. Unfortunately, I don't think it's a finished product right now. This definition right here is one example, and unfortunately, after all of this work, I'd hope that the council will disapprove this and move sectors to the next action. Thanks very much.
Just so I'm clear, your comment is not just to the motion, but in general, your organization is saying that sectors should not move forward?
Not at this point, as written right now. We feel that there are weaknesses, fatal flaws in the administration of sectors and the requirements that are laid out in this amendment, that until they're plugged, that sectors shouldn't go forward. And we'll talk about them as the other elements are discussed. Things about monitoring, about habitat impacts, bycatch, satisfying the national standards, that there are some things in there that just don't meet muster on this one. As I said, generally, we are supportive of sector allocation. I just don't think that the execution in this amendment satisfies those standards, and that there's going to be some exploitation of this program in the near future. Thanks.
Aaron?
Thank you. Aaron Doherty, Penobscot East Resource Center, Stonington, Maine. And I wanted to echo some of the earlier comments in support of allowing Handgear B, that's the open access handgear permits, to join a sector. Those permits are restricted to 250 hook maximum, and they have trip limits on them as well. And the concern is that if they were to stay in the common pool with a tack on the common pool potentially, and the common pool shutting down, that those vessels wouldn't be able to operate if the tack is met for the common pool. Secondly, if there's an opportunity to fold them into the sector, to have them be part of a sector that's, you know, focused on a specific area, and they could use the allocation that if they didn't bring an allocation to the sector, that any limited access permit that's in that sector would be able to share their allocation with them. So, again, as Tom Osmers from Martha's Vineyard said, it's an opportunity for younger fishermen and others who don't have those limited access permits to be able to participate in a sector under a hard tax system. So I just wanted to voice my support for that and to ask anyone, any member of this council, to offer up a motion that would allow Handgear B permits to operate within a sector in using the allocation that sector members bring to that sector. Thank you.
Anything further from the audience on the motion on the board? Warren.
My name is Warren Doty. I'm here in with three hats, I think. I'm on the board of directors of the Martha's Vineyard Dukes County Fishermen's Association. I'm also a selectman from the town of Chilmark. Working now? Yeah, okay. I'd like to commend your work moving toward sectors. I would disagree with what Oceana had to say a minute ago. I think the key to sectors is that you've moved toward a hard tack in the New England Groundfish Plan, and that's a very important move. We've worked with hard tacks in southern New England for a long time, hard tacks on fluke, striped bass, scup, sea bass. They can be managed. They can be managed well. And so moving toward one of the main things that we see about sectors is that you are moving toward a hard tack, and hard tacks can be made to work. In terms of our own sector, our Martha's Vineyard Penobscot East sector, we would be operating with a hard tack if you allow us to form this sector. And I would urge you to do what some of the other speakers have said in terms of allowing open access permits to join the sector. If we already have a hard tack on our sector, and so we have a control over how much fish we're going to catch, it seems to me very benevolent to allow a young man to fish inside that sector as long as the tack has been determined by catch history. On Martha's Vineyard, we have a lot of young men who are trying to put together a fishing career, and diversity is the name of the game. They need to put together different seasons to work and make a year's pay. We currently have a good fluke season in the summertime. We have a good striped bass season in the summertime. Both of those fisheries are working on a hard tack, and they will have a closing date. Traditionally, that fishery has closed August 15th to September 15th, and then we have spent a lot of time and a lot of money rebuilding our shellfish resource, so we have a very successful shellfish season throughout the fall. And what we're looking for is a wintertime codfish season. And allowing our sector to have some of these young guys that have striped bass permits, that have fluke permits, handline permits in the summertime, then they go shellfishing in the fall. If in the wintertime they could go codfishing, this would help us build the diverse seasons that we need to make our fishery work. So I would urge what Aaron said a minute ago to have an amendment made that would allow open access permits to join the sector. Thank you.
Mr. Libby.
Gary Libby, fisherman, Port Clyde, Maine. We're farming a sector. I think sectors are a good idea right now. We've gone so far with them now, I think to turn back would be a mistake. To the motion, people bring history in of the limited access permit into the sector, and the sector participants believe that they can work with the person. I don't see any problem with this motion, so I'm going to be in favor of it. And it does help the small communities in places like the Vineyard and down East Maine, and that's part of the National Standard 8 the way I read it. Thanks.
Anyone else? Okay, back to the council. Jim Audlin.
A couple of points. To the second bullet, there's two sections of the second bullet, and one is that a monkfish limited access permit be allowed to join a monkfish sector, and that would be on a future council action. But the second section of that is that we would exempt vessels in a sector from multi-species days of sea reductions. And the reason for that is that
multi-species days at sea and monkfish days at sea have to be used together. And then if we do a days at sea reduction, for instance, in one of the options that's 50%, a lot of people are going to be not have enough multi-species days to prosecute the monkfish fishery. And if a person's in a sector and they're under a hard tax, they don't need to have a cut of their multi-species days. So that was, I'm just putting the rationale out on the table for that section. And then I want to make one more point about whether we could have a motion to allow open access permits or hand gear permits to go into sectors. And I have a question to the chair, is that I don't think, or to Gene Martin, I don't think we took that option out to public hearing, and I'm not sure we could add that in at this time. So if we can, I'd like to know if we could, and if we can't, then we can't do anything about it.
The public hearing document did not contain notice that open access hand gear B permits could join a sector or were eligible to join a sector. Whether or not the council could take action today to allow that incorporation, not knowing whether there'd be any legal problems with allowing it to join and just focusing solely on whether or not it's in order. My view is that it would be in order. However, I'm not aware whether or not there are legal constraints to allowing an open access permit to join the sector. So I'd ask Gene Martin.
Well, my standard advice when, you know, in the 300 times I've been asked this question in the past, is that if a measure that's being added at the final council meeting is something that could have been contemplated, was within the scope in a general way, even if not specifically specified or quantifiably analyzed, then it probably can be added without going out to for further public comment and analysis. Again, remember that I should preface my statement by saying that legally, you can add this kind of provision to the amendment. The question is, do you then have to delay the final action in order to do a full analysis and to allow for additional public comment, which could interfere with the timing of this amendment? And so that's really what we're asking, is what additional analysis and public an opportunity for public comment should be allowed. And I think that, you know, a concept that is new and not really contemplated by the amendment that went out for public hearing document for public hearing comment is one that probably should undergo analysis and further public comment before you go forward. And it's not a strictly a legal question. It's mixed with policy, what the council thinks is necessary to ensure adequate analysis and public comment. But I think that you know, this is a concept I haven't heard of before today, and I think it is suspect in terms of whether it should be allowed to be added at this juncture. Again, with the understanding that we're just talking about timing here.
I think that's logical advice. I'd like to hear more discussion from the council on that point, if anyone has any to make. Dave Gate.
Well, I had a couple points relative to this motion, Mr. Chair. First, we received a report electronically by, I think his name's Seth, I don't know how to pronounce his last name, Minchenko. We got it Sunday night, and it was relative to the issue of sectors and how well they had been addressed, and I didn't know if the staff wanted to give a summary of that. I read it, but you know, it goes to a lot of the questions that the public just asked about, you know, the issue of how well educated, in this case it was the fishermen, have been in the sector concept. And the answer was they didn't, the academics that prepared the report didn't think that they had been well educated, that there'd been a massive public relations campaign to educate the American public, to send in form letters to
to push for sectors, but the fishing community, by and large, didn't have enough information. So I just note that for the record. Second thing I wanted to say was the permits and confirmation of permit history. I was the only person to vote against letting those in at the committee meeting. The more people you put in the fishery, the less there is for everybody overall. We're facing drastic mortality cuts here. I think we have a system to activate permits and confirmation of permit history now. I don't think we should ease up on that when we're telling everybody you're going to get a lot less. Nevertheless, I'm not going to make a motion to substitute because I lost the vote 9-1, and I realize that the best I can do is force a tie at the full council. To the third issue of should we let hand gear B permits into sectors, I would say people have had a lot of opportunity to come here and ask to have that put in at an earlier date. It has a lot of ramifications. For example, I don't think they have VMS. How are we going to track these boats? I don't think at the 11th hour and the 59th minute we should start adding things to the document that could have been added, you know, in the 9th hour or the 6th hour. They could have been, you know, they could have been discussed and vetted a long time ago. So I would not be in favor of adding these at this time.
Terry Stockwell, then Dr. Pierce, then Rodney.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the benefit of the council, tomorrow the Monkfish Committee is going to bring forward three recommendations relative to monkfish, ace, and groundfish sectors. A lot of discussion by a lot of people, and essentially I feel and others in the Monkfish Committee feel that the success of the groundfish sectors is going to be dependent upon bringing monkfish, ace into them. That being said, this motion here starts to pave the way towards perhaps a joint action or at least some recognition that we have to marry the plans in the future. We've got to provide incentives to move into the catch share program, and this is one. Concerning concerning allowing the open access permits into joining the sectors, I'm supportive of the concept, but the process today, to me, doesn't feel right. There's administrative and monitoring issues that haven't been resolved. I haven't thought about it, and I'd feel very uncomfortable about voting for it today.
Dr. Pierce?
The motion refers to the additional sector plan operations plan requirements, and it's a good list of additional requirements, and I'm glad that the committee has included has agreed to include these particular additional requirements, especially since they will enable us to better deal with the goals, with the objectives that the council has set for ourselves relative to sector management. What do we expect to get out of sectors? What do we hope will not happen with sector management? Specifically, I refer you to page 93 in the amendment itself. And there are a few, well, one objective in particular is especially important to me and to the Commonwealth, and that is prevent excessive consolidation that would eliminate the day boat fishery. This is a major issue. And frankly, I'm still not sure to what extent our approach for sectors will enable us to reach that goal, prevent excessive consolidation that would eliminate the day boat fishery. In my state, of course, and all the states, we're quite concerned about the day boat fisheries that have been impacted very significantly over the years by our groundfish management measures. So with that objective set for ourselves, I'm pleased to see that the committee has agreed to include in this list of additional requirements on page 95, identify potential redirection of effort as a result of sector operations and, if necessary, propose limitations to eliminate the adverse effects of any redirection of effort. And that the council needs to be reminded that there will be some unforeseen consequences of sector management as boats consolidate within sectors and they shift allocations around and they free up some vessels within their sector to pursue other fisheries. fisheries that may be in state waters, and that will then fall upon my shoulders to address relative to additional effort that may be exerted in state waters on groundfish or other species, fluke, sea bass, the suite of species into which vessels may go, fisheries into which vessels may go, if indeed they have the permits. So there'll be a lot of shuffling of the fleet, and we need to know what will happen, well, to the extent that we can know, what will be the redirection of the effort. That'll help us, the council, and others involved in the management of these other species, somehow deal with that redirection of effort and potentially additional fish and mortality. Another aspect of this list that's very good that I strongly favor is a list of all federal and state permits held by vessels participating in the fishery. We need to know what's going on. We need to know what's happening. Right now we have a simple situation, relatively so. We have two sectors, well-run sectors, in one specific location on Cape Cod in the Chatham area. You know that sector quite well, Mr. Chairman. So there's a, to me, from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, there's a certain level of confidence that that sector is being, those sectors are being run well because we have a lot of interaction with them. We, for the most part, know what they're doing. There's been a very open process, very frank exchange of information and discussion with the sectors and ourselves. However, we have a different situation now. Potentially, we will have many additional sectors up and down the coast, cross-cutting, overlapping, many different geographic areas, many different approaches, perhaps, for managing their specific allocations amongst themselves and within their sector, and transfers of ACE between sectors. It's going to be very complicated and very difficult to watch and to understand, to monitor, and we need to. We need to. Now, the service has much of that role now in the operations plans that are submitted to the service for its review and approval. I have a motion to make before we leave this particular topic, Mr. Chairman, after we're through with this business, but I just wanted to let you know that. So I favor the additional requirements. There are some more that I would like, and I've offered those up at previous committee meetings. I'm not going to offer them up now. I didn't make it through at the committee level, and I see no reason to offer them up now. As time unfolds, there may be some other things that we would like to have in the operations plans, and there'll be time to make those changes, I suspect. So it seems that this list is adequate, at least for now, for us to evaluate whether or not sector management, sector operation is actually helping us meet our council goals for four sectors. So I will support this motion. I think it's a step in the right direction regarding improved sector management.
Roddy.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have many of the same concerns David had, but I just want to go back to one is letting the hand gear into open access. It's not uncommon to catch a 10-pound codfish off of southern New England right now. It's happening every day. The fish are large. They're out there. And allowing 250 hooks on a vessel, that open category, that's 2,500 pounds a day on one vessel. Now, that fish has got to come off of somebody. So it's coming off of the people who have already paid the price. It's time we need to either cut bait or go fishing. So I'm against letting the open access permit in at this time. Thank you.
Mary Beth?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to offer an amendment to option 2 of section 4.3.3.2.2 on additional requirements. At the top of page 96, the amendment would be to strike the requirement for sector applicants to prepare a NEPA document. I know, unfortunately, most of these sectors have done that. But at the top of 96 in the document, it references the contracts drawn up by the Whiting and Pollock Cooperatives on the West Coast as a guide to developing NEPA documents. Developing a NEPA document is a huge undertaking. It's a huge cost that sectors have had to bear. I think it sets a policy as we move forward for catch shares and other programs that's unnecessary and not required. I just have absolutely no idea why we've moved down this road for NEPA document requirements. I've participated in drawing up contracts for cooperatives in the West Coast. There are no NEPA documents that those cooperatives, at least the one that I'm familiar with, had had to prepare. I think that preparing NEPA documents is the job of the agency and should not be a burden that we put on sectors as we move forward.
Is there a second? Seconded by Jim Odlin. I have a question on this. In those fisheries that you've been involved in with cooperatives, are they all allocated out? Are those fisheries, are they ITQ fisheries or in some other way an output control fishery already?
No, the fishery that I'm most familiar with was a limited access fishery, similar to what we have here in groundfish, multi-species. And the fishery moved from a limited access program with hard tax in place to a cooperative. I think there's a lot of similarities. There's a lot of differences, obviously, as well, but there was no NEPA document that was required.
I think in this instance we have a common pool and up to 19 sectors that could possibly form, and we have 11 months, I think, if I have my counting right, 11 months to get everything up and running. And I'm just thinking out loud, if we were to remove a requirement for NEPA analysis, at least at this point, at the sector-by-sector level, how that analysis would be accomplished. I would assume it would fall on council staff at this point to somehow work with up to 19 different sectors to analyze the potential sector-level impacts, the cumulative impacts of both those sectors, their operation plans, and whatever we put forward in Amendment 16 for the common pool, and then somehow submit it and get it approved by May 1st.
Well, in the case that I'm familiar with, the document that moved forward, the allowing the fishery to move towards cooperatives, was considered the NEPA document. And this document does reference sectors throughout the document. Whether or not it's sufficient, I guess I'm probably not personally the one to judge that. But it does do analysis of what we're doing here with sectors. And certainly in my West Coast, you know, example, Amendment 80 was the NEPA document, and perhaps Jim could comment on this because I think that he is familiar with that process.
Anyone else in the council? Pat Kirk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, the NEPA document is required. I don't think there's anything debatable there. The sectors do have the option of incorporating the NEPA document into their operations plan, and you know, maybe that would be more consistent with the model that's being discussed. The reason that the sector applicants prepare the NEPA document is because it directly follows from the NEPA document has to be consistent with how they intend to operate and lay out the procedures and requirements of the sector. So it only makes sense, in my opinion anyway, for the applicants to prepare the document. If we were to prepare the document instead of the sector applicants, then we'd be looking at delaying this amendment for a very long time. So I'm opposed to the motion.
Anyone else on the council? All right, Beth.
Well, I'm certainly not interested in delaying the document, but I continue to be frustrated by this discussion because I just cannot see why in one region of the country you can move forward with a cooperative and there's no requirement for these NEPA documents, and here that there is. I don't understand it. So if it's truly going to delay the document, I would withdraw the motion, but I'm still very frustrated by that.
Jim?
Yeah, thank you. I understand the question. And, of course, all of the federal actions have to comply with NEPA, so there surely was some NEPA document that was established and was the basis for that co-op decision. And there's lots of ways to do NEPA, whether that West Coast decision was set up differently, but there surely was a NEPA document of some kind. And so I think that Pat's Kirkle's comment that this can't go forward without NEPA is true. And so perhaps here it becomes a little question of logistics and how to get everything done on time.
Mary Beth?
So I guess, you know, I've expressed my frustration. We can forget about this motion for now. I think it would delay.
You're asking to withdraw. We've had some debate, but I'll allow it if a seconder agrees. Okay.
No objections.
Are there any objections? Okay, the motion's withdrawn. Anything further on this motion? Gene Martin.
A couple of points that came up during the discussion. One is the second bullet about allowing monkfish limited access permits, is this intended, just to be clear, if this passes and the agency approves this amendment, is it clear that at this point in time, monkfish limited access permits will not be allowed to join a sector based on Amendment 16 only, that there needs to be some future action by the monkfish plan and or the groundfish committee or oversight committee to allow this to happen, to work out all the details, to determine whether monkfish limited access permits would need a special groundfish permit to participate, etc. I mean, this is just as I understand, this is just a placeholder until future action by the council. Is that correct?
That's my read on the motion. Defer to the chair or any other council member if they have a different opinion. Seeing none, I think your interpretation is correct, Gene.
And then the second question is, there was a question raised about the size of sectors, and the commenter said that he'd been advised that one person could form a sector. Now, that's not how I interpret the definition, which is written in terms of plural, persons entering into a contract. You can't enter into a contract with yourself. So I think it needs to be clarified here whether there is a minimum size of persons, which is a distinct legal entity, by the way, that can form a sector. Is that something that has been clarified and it's just not clear here, or is it something that we want to clarify at this point in time? Because the way it's currently written in the document, it refers to persons entering into a contract, which at least requires two persons, and one would not meet that definition.
Mark Gibson.
Yeah, that was going to be my question, based on the comments from Oceana in the audience. Could a single, fishing entity constitute a sector? And it's something that we faced with our pilot summer flounder sector that we activated this summer. Perhaps shame on us, we weren't prepared for the inevitable question when an individual came forward and, can I be my own sector? And we said, well, no, we're not ready for that yet. It's a pilot program, but I don't know that we would have sustained a challenge on that had that come forward. So I think we're right to consider that improved definition now on what constitutes the minimum size of a sector, lest we have a situation where individuals come forward and in some way trigger a referendum requirement and that sort of thing. I would suggest we clarify at this point. I don't have a suggestion right now, then following Gene, it has to be at least two to be plural.
Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, I think maybe the question you want to ask yourself, and this would be a question for Gene, is a person owns multiple permits, and those permits are all separate corporate entities. My understanding of a corporate entity is a person in law. So if a guy has 20 permits and 20 corporations, he could form a sector because all the corporations are different corporations. They would, in fact, be controlled by one person. But in the eyes of the law, they're still 20 people.
Well, I would like to see that clarified because, we have that question now with various issues in our fisheries as to whether, in terms of transferring permits between different corporate entities, and also in terms of defining the percentage share of scallop vessel owners, for example. And the current legal advice that we've given on this is that there are exceptions to this idea that a corporate entity is really a separate person to another corporate entity if they are owned by the same persons. I mean, the common vernacular is you pierce the corporate veil. There's really not the fact that they're set up as separate corporate entities does not mean that they don't share common ownership interests and are really owned by one particular person or group of persons. And so I think the question that Dave asked is an important one as to whether the council would like to allow that kind of situation where a vessel owner owns numerous vessels under separate corporate entities to form a sector by itself, or whether we should continue the policy that if a vessel owner is shares common interest and does not really qualify under common law with respect to whether they are a separate legal entity or not, then they aren't going to be considered as separate persons. So it would be helpful to have that kind of guidance from the council. I mean, it's legally you can do it any way you want. But we're going to have to interpret this the way the definition's written now. It leaves it to interpretation, and that's another option, I presume, is that we'll interpret the way that we think it's intended, which, to be consistent with our past interpretations, would mean that one person that has that owns multiple vessels through corporate entities may not qualify for the definition. Under the definition.
Let me see if I can try to restate what I think I heard you say with a question, actually. Are you suggesting that there is a way to word a legal let's say the council decides it doesn't want a sector to form where there's really one maestro, one owner, with multiple, the Dave Gaethel scenario. And it says, you know what, we want it to be a minimum of three distinct owners as the minimum size of a sector. Are you suggesting there's a way to write that so that it's airtight and there's no way to get around it? Is there a legal construct that you could...
Well, there's no airtight legal construct, but I think you would write it in terms of that, well, using your example, that a sector must be comprised of a minimum of three persons, none of whom have common ownership interest in the other two persons or the vessels that are owned by those persons. Now that's, you know, nothing, I can't guarantee anything is airtight, but that's how we've defined, for example, in the scallop industry, the regulations that apply to the scallop industry when they first came out with respect to whether one vessel could start combining permits on other vessels owned by the same person in order to fish an unlimited amount of days at sea.
Frank Blount.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we're probably spending a lot of time here on something that we're not going to be able to make airtight. Somebody who owns, and I'll use a scallop example, if somebody owns 10 scallop boats, they have a very good lawyer, and they're going to get around this. You can put something in trust that somebody else has, the trust can have 100% ownership of it, and you can still maintain the management of it. That's a very simple way around it, and that's just one little example. I mean, I don't see any way that you can make this ironclad for what we're trying to do. I think if somebody's got a separate corporation, if they're going to get around it. And trying to sit on the fly here to make a regulation or a rule, I don't think we can do it.
Here's what I'm going to do. We've gone 90 minutes. I'm going to give us a 10-minute break to stew it over. When we left, we had a motion on the board
turn it over to Rip Cunningham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In an effort to continue to move this along, I would like to make a motion to amend the motion that we have on the board by adding one additional bullet. I gave my copy to Karen, so I'm going to have to look at the board to read it into the record. That a sector will be defined as three or more persons, none of whom have ownership interests in the other two persons' vessels in that sector. The council will defer to NIMS on how to administer this provision.
There's a second. Seconded by Dave Preble. Discussion on the motion to amend. Rodney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Somebody hit.
I thought them days were over. I have a question. Now, some of the sectors have already formed. Supposing there's somebody in one of those farm sectors that owns multiple corporations, and he's by himself.
The intent was that if there were, you know, more than three people, that person could have some ownership interest in some others.
Supposing he's all alone, but he had five boats, and he started a sector with it, and he's already got his paperwork in. That's what I'm saying. Is he kicked out?
If I understand your question, the existing sectors, this wouldn't be a problem for them.
That was my question. I probably phrased it wrong. But.
Okay.
We only have two. Which exists?
Jim Ovin.
I don't want to complicate this, but you're saying the existing sectors that are in place now, but what about the ones that have already applied, the existing formed sectors? I think that's what Rodney's asking.
Is that what you're asking, Rodney? Okay, then my answer was not correct, because I don't know what the composition of the other applicants is. Doug.
Just a clarification on the motion as the way it reads. It says three or more persons, none of whom have ownership interest in the other two persons' vessels. Well, what if you have three or more? It could be 10 people. Don't we need to take out the two, just say in the other person's vessels in that sector? No.
Jane?
Yeah, I mean, there may be a more artful way of writing this, but basically it means that if there's more than three, then a vessel owner could have ownership interest in other vessels in that sector, as long as at least two of the other persons in that sector don't have common ownership interest in that third person's vessel. You see what I'm saying?
Rodney.
Gene, could you just go over that one more time?
Well, there has to be at least three persons in a sector that have no common ownership interest. Once you meet that requirement, then a vessel owner can have as many boats as he wants, I guess, that he owns or his corporate entities own.
Thank you.
Okay.
Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for Gene. Is there any key wording that we should have in this that would make this a little cleaner?
We could probably make it cleaner, but I think, you know, it, in the interest of time, that's the last sentence is meant to clean this up in the regulations, and the public will have opportunity to comment on whether that correctly clarifies and captures the intent of this.
Dr. Pierce.
I can see the reasoning behind it, but if I was one guy owning 12 boats and I'm one of my own sector, okay, I'm moving it forward. I intend to, you know, take advantage of sector rules to be efficient, be economic. And if I find out now that this has passed, I guess it wouldn't pose a problem for me. I'd go find a couple of friends with permits, small players, and I'd invite them in. And I'm okay. I'd still get away with what I'm getting away with, if I'm trying to get away with anything at all. What's the consequence? It's easy to get around. someone can opt, it's a self-selecting sector, and there are enough permits out there so that this criteria can be met. Again, the reasoning is good. I understand the why it's being offered up, but I don't think in the long run it's going to be effective because it's not attached to any specific objective or policy that this council has set regarding how sectors are to perform, how they are to interact with each other. So I don't see it accomplishing anything significant.
Anything further from the council? Since this is a motion to amend, I'll go to the audience. Maggie?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the industry's understanding from the start has been that a sector would have to be at least two separate individuals. I'm not certain, but I think there may be one of the proposed sectors that is two individuals. So to make this kind of change at this time, it's really problematic because that does, as Dr. Pierce just said, kind of force that person to go out and find another person to join their sector, and then what if they can't find somebody that they actually want to be in their sector with them? I mean, this is a pretty serious situation regarding sector membership and who people want to do business with. So I guess if it were two or more persons, then I wouldn't have a problem with that because, again, I think that's how the industry has interpreted the definition to date, that persons is plural, meaning at least two. So I would urge you not to define it as three or more persons. Thank you.
Mr. Libby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gary Libby, Port Clyde. My question is kind of a question here. When you talk about ownership, we have a co-op in Port Clyde, and we're all even owners in the co-op. Would all the boats in there have a common ownership because they're in a co-op, or would they be individuals because they all own their individual vessel?
I can't answer that, Gary.
Okay. All right. But I'm assuming that it means ownership of vessel. If it's that way, then there's really not a problem with it. But just the co-op idea is what I was thinking about. Thanks.
Dan Holland.
Dan Holland, Gulf of Maine Research Institute. I just have a question, and that is, would this preclude a community-based organization, a permit bank, from being a sector? If it was a community-based entity, nonprofit, how it was formed, owned a bunch of permits and wanted to form its own sector, would that be precluded?
I would assume so. If the permits are all owned by one owner, yeah. Peter?
Peter Shelley, Conservation Law Foundation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We would support this motion. The document speaks in terms of a group of persons forming these sectors, and I think certainly the common understanding of that phrase meant that you would have some multiple ownerships in the sector, and it would not be manipulated to allow people to consolidate down to one controlling interest. So we would support the motion.
Back to the council. Dana.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think I can add any light to this, but I think it's important to point out, I think it is important for me to say that there seems to be some realization at this point that sectors may be a way that we want to go, but this is a slippery slope. I think we should have thought things through a lot lot closer before. It's it may be the saving grace for some people, but it's there are a lot of unanswered questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anyone else on the council on the motion to amend? Ready for the question on the motion to amend? Raise your hand if you favor it. Ten. Opposed? Five in opposition. Six in opposition. Abstentions? One abstention. Motion to amend carries 10-6 with one abstention. Back on the main motion as amended. Anything further? Sally.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The opposite end of the spectrum of what we've just been talking about is the hand gear B permits. And, you know, I understand some of the discussion that was had around the council table on this subject, but I think that if someone who holds an open access hand gear B permit wants to join a sector, isn't bringing any ACE into the sector, but the sector wants that person to be allowed in, and that person is willing and what must be subject to all of the requirements of sector participation, such as VMS monitoring requirements, then they should be allowed in. It's the other end of the spectrum that we're just talking about. People are concerned about consolidation and large operators and what might happen with them. The other end of that is, you know, what happens to people who are more on the margins of the fishery, and if they want to participate on a part-time basis or on a much smaller scale than what we were just talking about in this amendment to the main motion that just passed, I think they should. So I'm going to offer a motion to amend to allow hand gear B permits to join a sector subject to all requirements of sector participation.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dana Rice. Discussion on the motion to amend, Jim Odlin.
Well, I kind of thought we had this discussion about open category and hand gear permits 20 minutes ago, and that we were the gist that I got out of the discussion was that we can do this, but we could delay the amendment. And I didn't want to take that risk. I would have offered the motion. So I'm going to oppose the motion based on that the advice we got was it could delay the amendment. So I'm opposed to this motion at this time.
Terry Stockwell.
Get up.
Frank Blount.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I 100% support the idea of adding them in, but I'm very leery of doing it at this late hour. And also, I look at the motion that was just passed. If you get an open access hand gear permit, and I want to form a sector by myself, it's very easy to get two people to go get open access permits, put them on a skiff, and I've got my sector by myself. There's the loophole in the law we were trying to get around.
Put it right in speech. What do you think? Anyone else on the council?
Yeah, I just want to make sure people realize that the hand gear B permits are not a closed category. There's not a fixed gear pool of hand gear P permits. Anyone can get one at any time. So in essence, by making this change, you're allowing any vessel to participate in a groundfish sector merely by asking for and receiving a hand gear B permit. I think, unless NIMS would correct me on that.
Anyone else? Ready for the motion to vote on the motion to amend? All those in favor, raise your hand. Two. Opposed?
Fifteen
opposed. Back on the main motion as amended. Anything further? Ready for the question. All those in favor, raise your hand. Seven, unanimous. Rip.
We are moving on to...
Thank you, David.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have one other issue and a motion to make relative to this section of the plan. And it relates to operations plans. As I've already indicated, I'm quite interested in operations plans from the state perspective, and this council, of course, is too. There'll be many different operations plans with many different approaches as to how the different sectors will remain within the guidelines that they create for themselves and the rules by which the sector participants will operate. There may be caps, COD caps, that who knows what's going to be offered up. And frankly, I'd like to be, and all council members should be part of the process for review of those operations plans and approval of those operations plans. As it stands now, the operations plans are developed, and then the final operations plan is then submitted to the service, and the service then reviews the operations plans and may consult with the council. Doesn't have to, but may consult with the council. This is the big thing. I mean, this is huge, especially if we have the kind of participant in sectors that we expect. The participation could be tremendous. At least that's the anticipation, and I think the hope for by this council. I definitely would like to have, you know, council members should have a major role in review of operations plans, for example, that would result in shifts of effort into different fisheries. We need to consider that, debate that, discuss that, and then strongly influence the operations plan and what they intend to do within the sector. For example, I expect right now, this is the state perspective I'm speaking about now, relative to lobster. I think it's very likely that if a lot of sectors are created with many different participants, there could be a dramatic shift of effort onto the lobster fishery. And that is something that my state and I think the other states are quite concerned about. I'd like to be involved in the review of an operations plan that would result in that happening and have a say, a final say, in whether or not that would happen. Another issue, again, a state perspective, and I think all states should share this perspective. We are going to have, every state is going to have a very interesting and challenging situation, because if we have all these sectors with all these operations plans, with all sorts of rules and regulations, exemptions from possession limits, maybe specific possession limits, states are somehow going to have to respond. And right now we have landing possession limits that cut across all gear types for specific stock areas, all in support of council actions. We have to deal with that. I mentioned before, potential shift of effort into state waters fisheries. We have to deal with that as well, to control it, to make sure that things don't get out of hand, that our objectives are not subverted, our state objectives are not subverted in any way. So, you know, with all that said, I feel it's important, critically important, for this council to not rely solely on the National Marine Fisheries Service to make all these important decisions. We, in a sense, give up. We pass over the responsibility for much of the management of the ground fish fleet to the National Marine Fisheries Service with an understanding that the service may consult with us. Likely they will. I mean, this is a partnership, correct? Still, I'd like to have this partnership made a little bit more formal and more consistent with the fact that we, the New England Fishery Management Council, you know, make very faithful management decisions. So I would move that sector operations plans must be reviewed and approved by the New England Council as well as the National Marine Fisheries Service.
Is there a second? Seconded by Mark Gibson. Discussion on the motion. Jim Odlin.
Yeah, we had this discussion at the committee, and what we ended up figuring out was that the timing doesn't work. You would move the submission of an operations plan several months forward in order for the council to have time to make its comments, and that I think the service told us that the operations plans go to proposed rule, final rule, and that there's opportunity to comment during that period, so that because of the timing issue, the committee did not move forward with this type of motion, and I have a timing issue problem, so I would have to vote against it, even though I would like it to work. I just can't see the timing issue. People will have to decide they're going to be in a sector now probably a year and a half before they want to implement. So it's just not practical. Thank you.
Anyone else on the council? Doug?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with Dave's concept here that the states are going to need to have some review and and input into these plans because of some of the many reasons that Dave listed, in addition to enforcement, being able to appropriately enforce this with different trip limits or no trip limits or different measures that may be in different sectors, especially in states where there's different sectors. So we have to have some kind of ability to review and comment besides just sending a letter into NIMS.
Rep.
Thank you. I just wanted to reiterate what Jim brought up, particularly since the operations plans have to be submitted by the 1st of September for these current sectors. And so I think that I understand the reasoning and agree with a lot of the comments that are being made. But I think we're in a situation right now that we're really forced, at least with this go-round, to accept them, whether there's some mechanism we can do it for, you know, subsequent operations plans, because those are done on an annual basis. But I think right now we're sort of stuck moving it ahead the way it is.
Rodney?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm hearing two different messages. I'm hearing one is the council needs to review it, and the second I'm hearing the states want it. That's what I'm hearing. As far as council members, we don't have any legal staff. I mean, we've got Gene, but we don't have legal expertise. I'm sorry, Dave. But I'm just saying, you want us to review legal operations plans? That doesn't make sense. We have enough time trying to manage fish. Never mind corporations or plants. So I'm against this. Thank you.
Terry?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I concur with Dave and Doug's points about states' rights and needs to review the operation plans. I feel very comfortable in our ability to review via a public comment letter, and I don't think it's necessary to move this motion forward.
Anyone wishing to speak in favor of the motion? Mark?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I understand there's a timing problem here, but I think Dave is right on with the needs of the states to have input into these. Rhode Island has some very fresh experience and sometimes unpleasant experience in trying to formulate possession limit seasons and so have you in support of federally managed species. That's only going to get more complicated, more difficult as sectors go forward and as they are released of some of their other regulatory requirements. So I wish we could find a way to provide the states with adequate input and not tie up the amendment. Thank you.
Anyone in the audience? Mr. Libby?
Gary Libby, Port Clyde. I agree with the timing factor that this is probably not good run through the council process just because of the workloads and the timing, and I'd oppose it. Thanks.
Anyone in the audience wishing to speak in favor of the motion? Okay, back to the council. Anything further? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. 4. Opposed? Thirteen. So the motion fails 4-13. Dr. Pierce.
Well, if it's a question of timing, and I appreciate that, perhaps the council would favor a review and approval of future operations plans for the coming years. So I would move that future operations plans must be reviewed and approved by the council and the National Marine Fisheries Service.
Is there a second? Seconded by Doug. Mary Beth?
I would ask Pat to comment on the timing issue. If you look down the road and people have to make these applications at a certain time of the year, do you run into the same problem, regardless of whether we're talking about future ones or current?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I assume the last motion applied both to the current plans as well as the future plans, and the timing issue is exactly the same. Now, the council does have the option of approving the sectors first, so the council sees what's proposed by the sectors in their approval of them, and then they again do have the option of commenting during the proposed rule stage, and haven't yet on any of the operations plans we've had. We can certainly share drafts of the operations plans with the states earlier in the process if they're interested, and that would be helpful.
Dave Gaith.
Yeah, I think a lot simpler way for the states to proceed with this is for the states to require that the operations plans be submitted to the states. If a boat plans to, if a sector plans to land fish in the state or has vessels with permits from that state, that the states require that they submit the operations plan to them at the same time they submit it to the National Marine Fisheries Service. Now, I don't think the council has any expertise here, particularly in reviewing sector operations plan. It's not how I really want to spend my day. I think the states, if the states feel they have an expertise or need this information, then they should require it as a matter of state law. I don't think it's something the council has to get involved in. So I'm going to vote against the motion.
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, the operations plans are not just about legalities. They're about specific measures that the sectors will use to manage their race. I just thought the council would want to be in a more formal way, in a more dramatic way, consistent with our responsibilities, would want to look at those plans and evaluate them relative to our specific objectives that we have established for sector management. If that's not the case, then fine. There may be another way to deal with this, because if this fails, I have another motion to make. In the plan itself, it says that a sector must submit its preliminary operations plan to the council no less than 1 year prior to the date that it wants to begin operations. So I assume that means that the operations plans will be submitted to the council every year prior to, in other words, there'll be some advanced thinking by each sector. So the council will have all of those plans that will be revised, I assume, from 1 year to the next. So we will have an opportunity to look at those plans. So perhaps the best way to do this is to say that the council will review and approve the preliminary operations plan. Then later on, the final operations plan would be solely the responsibility of the National Marine Fisheries Service, and consistent with what David Gaithel just said, perhaps the states would find themselves in a position to, that we would move forward and actually have some state rules and regulations that would impact those who land in our states that would involve us in a more formal way with sector management plans. I don't want to do that. I would rather have the council do that, because we're all part of the council. Why have a lot of different separate state initiatives and review by the different states? I'd rather have it, under this umbrella. We are all part of the council process. You note the nature of the hands that went up on the last vote. I think they were all state directors, representatives of the agency. So clearly there's an interest on the part of the states to have this sort of review. Anyways, the motion is as it stands. And if it fails, I might make another motion relative to the preliminary operations plan.
I think we've had this debate. I'm going to call the question. You ready? All those in favor, raise your hand. 4. 5. 5. 5 in favor. Opposed? I have 11 abstentions. I had 12. 5 to 12. Dave, you need to make.
I'm going to give it one more
eight
try.
Eight more motions if you pick one up every time.
One more try. Pass. One more try. Again, this is about states' interests, states' rights. We're all raising our hands, expressing our concern, and the council as a whole is not giving us a favorable response. So I'll make what I think is a reasonable motion and course of action. I would move that sectors must submit preliminary operations plans to the council for review and approval. NIMS must consult with the council and will solicit public comment on the operations plans consistent with the Administrative Procedures Act. One notable change here is that the language in the plan as it exists now goes from may consult to will consult.
Need a second before discussion. Is there a second? Is there a second? Seconded by Jim Fair. Tom Neese?
Yeah, I realize that there are portions of Amendment 16 that are textually awkward, but I think there's a little bit of a misunderstanding here. The requirement to submit a preliminary operations plan a year in advance is for the first time a sector wants to operate. And that's part of the formation proposal, part of forming a sector, so that the council has time to consider and incorporate that into our management process and get a document sent over to NIMS so that the thing can be implemented. The operations plan requirement after that is that you submit it by September 1st. So, I mean, that's, I think, how everyone has been interpreting this section in the past. Not that every year a sector has to submit a preliminary operations plan a year before the next fishing year.
Jim Allen.
So, hearing what Tom just said, that means that this will be a submittal once by a sector on their preliminary application will go to the council, which it does anyway, and to National Marine Fisheries Service the first time they form a sector. After that, there is no preliminary operations plan, so it doesn't happen on an annual basis. Is that my understanding of what this would do and what will be in effect if we go forward with what's there?
Well, I think that's what the amendment says now. I'm not sure that's what the maker of the motion means.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get out.
I'll go to the maker.
Yeah, in light of the way in which people jump forward to second my motion, and in light of the comments made by Tom Neese, I'll withdraw the motion with an understanding my concerns are still there on the table, and it's very likely now that I, the Commonwealth, and the other states are going to have to rethink how we deal with sectors' operations plans, especially in the context of how they will affect the way in which we have to revise, modify, in some cases dramatically so, our state rules and regulations to accommodate all of these sectors. And, of course, at this point in time, we don't know how many sectors there will be. We don't know what the rules and regulations within the sectors will be, how they will operate. So it's going to be a fascinating and a challenging experience for us. We'll take it on, of course, but now the ball is in our court relative to how we handle these operations plans.
No objection to withdrawing the motion? Okay. Rip.
Now we will move on to allocation of resources, section 4.3.3.3. We'll go to Tom for any comments.
This is a broad section. It really has a number of issues that are perhaps of critical importance to the industry. I believe that the committee kind of broke them up into two issues, and I think the motions that are going to be brought forward brought them into two issues. So the first is that, obviously, the no-action alternative is an alternative throughout this amendment, and if that were to happen, There would be no change in the provisions for allocation of resources. To be more specific, we can look at these in two ways. There are some general issues that this section addressed, and then there is a specific issue of how do we determine the potential sector contribution of each permit. I'm going to address right now just the general stuff, and then as we move on, we can address the potential sector contribution issues next. Amendment 13 actually allows a sector to form with either a hard tack or using days at sea in order to control its catch. This section changes that and removes the possibility for a sector forming that uses days at sea. It also makes it clear that a sector has to require a tack of everything that is allocated. Amendment 16 was a little vague on that. Our two existing sectors only requested a tack for Georges Bank cod. So if the revisions are adopted, every sector will no longer be able to get days at sea and operate under days at sea, which, frankly, no one has done. They will be required to get a tack of everything that is allocated. The other changes that are in here is that there is a proposal to remove the limit on how much of a share of a stock a sector can be allocated, currently set at 20% by Amendment 13. There's another provision that is meant to facilitate transfer of ACE and monitoring of sector quotas, where 20% of a sector's ACE for each stock is withheld at the start of a year for 61 days. This also introduces the new concept, a new term that we call annual catch entitlement. This is ACE. You'll hear that thrown around throughout the day. It is basically the pounds of fish that a sector can catch in a given year. I think that covers everything in the general section.
There were no specific public comments on this, so I will make a motion on behalf of the committee that the council approve section 4.3.3.3.1, revised allocation of resource guidelines. The council adds Southern New England, Mid-Atlantic winter flounder, and Atlantic wolffish, if added to the management unit, to the list of stocks not allocated, but allocation of the Southern New England, Mid-Atlantic winter flounder stock can be considered in the biennial specifications framework process in the event that a future assessment indicates ACE can be made available. Pass the committee 10-0. Section 4.3.3.2, option 1. That passed the committee 8-2 with two abstentions. The sub-option 1 for the treatment of sector overages was 9 and 1 abstention. Section 4.3.3.3, option 2, for the U.S.-Canada area allocations, which are separate allocations, that was 10-0.
Okay, that was a committee motion. I'll go to the audience for discussion or comments on any of these items. Bob?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob St. Pierre, the fixed gear sector out of Chatham, Mass. We have a concern with the potential for any sector to have up to 100% share of any given stock. I know when we formed our sector, the maximum was 20%, and that made a lot of sense to me, and I understand that that number potentially may have to be increased. But for a sector to have that potential, to own up to 100%, I think is a little bit frightening, especially for small communities and sectors that are going to be operating with very small percentages of certain shares of certain stocks. And basically, that's my concern. Thank you.
Maggie?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The chairman of the committee, I think, said that there was no public comment on this issue, and I just wanted to point out that Associated Fisheries Maine did support adding Southern New England Mid-Atlantic winter flounder to the provision for no allocation. And the Groundfish Advisory Panel recommended that as well. Thank you.
I see a hand, but not a face. He's in the back. Eric?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Eric Brazier, Hook Fishermen's Association and GB Cod Sector Manager. I'd like to make 2 points. The first one would be to support the gentleman who just got up. There are some concerns in Chatham about the potential for a sector to own 100% of a stock. We don't support the removal of this 20% cap that was implemented in Amendment 13 without some sort of additional discussion about a further, more reasonable cap. We don't want to see sectors, potential sectors who have already closed their roster or may be considering closing their roster have to go back to people they've already committed to and tell them, by the way, we said yes, you can join, but in fact, we'll have to turn you away. We don't support that. But we do support some discussion about a more reasonable ownership cap and one that further may be reviewed on an annual basis to be adjusted as the fishery, the composition of the fishery itself changes and evolves. Point number two I'd like to make, if in 2010 we vote in common pool measures that will allow or even quite frankly promote overfishing, we won't know this until 2012. So essentially we're giving a bye to those members in 2010 and 2011. What's to prevent a fisherman from overfishing in the common pool for 2 years and then dodging the penalty associated with that by joining a sector in 2012? I see that sub-option 1 and sub-option 2 addresses the opposite scenario of a fisherman that overfishes in a sector and then leaves to join the common pool. But as a sector manager, I'm very concerned that this document lacks any sort of measures of accountability for vessels that overfish for up to two years in the common pool and then join the sector in 2012 to dodge the consequences. Thank you.
Chris.
Chris Brown, Point Judith, the Rhode Island Commercial Fishermen Association. I understand the need to not allocate winter flounder to sectors in an attempt to get the sector off the ground, but please don't lose sight of how we got to this point. The GARM was very clear in the fact that the stock assessment on flounder was not its proudest moment, to put it mildly. We're seeing some flounders. They are a long way from deserving of the assessment that they have. Having said that, I think there needs to be some incentive to revisit the scientific evaluation of that stock. There should be some effort made to get that off of that which we cannot allocate. I don't think it is I think it's a poor service to the fishermen to simply say, lousy stock assessment. We'll just push it aside, we won't allocate, and move on down the road. In this case, a poor stock assessment of a very important fish to us is really it's going to take it to us. So I don't know what you can do. I understand the need to not allocate, but I just I can't tell you how badly I think that the science needs to be revisited so that we get that. We don't feel as if we've done the fishermen and the process a service by simply not allocating. We should continue as a council, hopefully, to push for a species-specific stock assessment on this fish so that maybe we can get it open back up. Thank you.
Vito.
Peter Giuloni, not the Seafood Coalition. Just wondering if it's worth adding some clarity or if there's a more mechanical way to set this up as opposed to waiting for the biennial assessment, and also just to say allocate it is to maybe make it clear that it would be allocated in the manner that it would have had it been allocated in Amendment 16 up front. So we don't end up with a new allocation discussion in the event ACE shows up. And, you know, we have heard there are different efforts at the Science Center and you know, and elsewhere to try to get some emergency or more focused relook at, and should we wait that long for the process? Is there a way to set something up that said, you know, maybe punt it to the PDT or someone to determine some level of ACL that would trigger making it make sense to start retaining winter flounder? Because from a scientific standpoint, if we discard all the winter flounder, we're never going to get a better stock assessment. So, you know, if we end up having ACE, it would be terrible to end up in a technicality that, hey, you know, the new science says there's 800 ton that can be harvested, but we've surrendered to zero possession and non-allocation, so we're going to continue to do that. You know, if there's a mechanical way to set it up that upon the time that ACE is available, allocate it this way and have the RA implement it. So the council's already spoken on it. Otherwise, you're basically leaving this open for an allocation discussion and a biennial adjustment and then a subjective decision as to how much ACL can be available before we allocate it, because they're not putting that up. You know, is it 100 ton or is it 1,000 ton?
Nancy, to those points?
Well, yeah, just in terms of what it is the Science Center is, in fact, doing relative to southern New England winter flounder, we are, in fact, looking at updating. We are, in fact, updating a lot of the data that go into the assessment. But quite frankly, at this point, I can't see that the science advice is going to be different. We can take a look at the new information and incorporate it into the assessment, but quite frankly, at this point, I don't see that the advice is going to change.
Vito, I know one of your concerns was if new information becomes available, is it just a spec process? If you notice in the amendment or the motion, it also references the ability to use a framework. I don't know if that, in some instances, it could be quicker. But I think if new science comes online, it's going to have to get loaded through the system, which includes the SSC. So, back to the audience. Joel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Joel Hovenesian, Rhode Island Fishermen's Alliance. To build on what Chris Brown was saying, I'd like to bring it to the Council's attention that in the recent NEMAP survey in southern New England this spring, their retention of blackback flounders was higher than their retention of summer flounder, which is a rebuilt fishery. We need to give this some consideration. As Chris said, it's a disservice to the fishermen and to the resource to go down this path, which will inevitably lead to much more regulatory discard than we should be getting to. I understand that it's a difficult thing to incorporate this, but the fact of the matter remains that there's a lot of evidence that the winter flounder resource is in nowhere near the shape that the recent assessments deem it. So I just ask the council to give that consideration. Thank you.
I see your hand. Bonnie?
Basically, Bonnie Brady, Long Island Commercial Fishing Association. I am basically echoing what the other Rhode Island fishermen have said regarding the winter flounder, and I know that some of you have received information regarding the aggregate pounds of winter flounder caught compared to summer flounder in tows from Cape May to Montauk. Apparently, in 30 tows, there was a 2-to-1 aggregate poundage caught. I'm not sure exactly as to how. I know you were saying within a framework. possibility. But when you get to option three, which you all are going to be voting on later, lo and behold, New York takes the biggest hit in ground fish trip revenue, followed, I believe, by Rhode Island and Connecticut. So I would really appreciate, since obviously you're a council that is regulating one of our fisheries, not our primary fishery, obviously, but it's becoming death by a thousand cuts. And we'd appreciate some input and help. Thank you.
Okay, back to the council. Jim Wadler.
Yeah, I just want to clarify that the committee worked on this issue of what to do with the Southern New England, Mid-Atlantic, winter flounder, and that's why we added the addition of that it will be, if ACE becomes available, it will happen in a specification process or the biannual process. And then secondly, I do think there is we ought to have an addition to this, and I will make a motion that when ACE becomes available for Southern New England, Mid-Atlantic flounder, that the allocation of this stock will be based, will be used the same criteria as all the other multi-species stocks is allocated.
Is there a second? Seconded by Mark Gibson. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, the rationale of the motion is that we're going to be going forward with a zero possession limit and zero catch, so we should use the same criteria as all the other multi-species when we, in the future, have to allocate this stock based on when there was a catch. So that's the rationale for the motion. Thank you.
Anything further on the motion to amend? Dave Gatel.
Just a question. It's part of the overall motion as well as a motion to amend. Is there any more formulaic way to make this happen automatically than what the committee came up with? I mean, we struggle with this, trying to come up with a way that, you know, if ACE becomes available, that it's just automatically credited to the vessels instead of, you know, this framework and, you know, what could be potentially a six-month to two-year process. So that's a question to the chair.
Well, I think we've taken care of the mechanism in terms of how the allocation would occur, the ACE allocation would occur. As far as uploading or loading in new scientific information, that's not really our role. There's a SOSARC process, and from time to time there could be special data poor workshops. We've had those in the past, but that's really outside the purview of the council in terms of scheduling or forcing those to occur. We can certainly comment as to our concern or request that special attention is paid to this situation. I think it would be a redundant message. Nonetheless, it may be an important one to send. But again, I think as far as the mechanism of turning a good stock assessment or a more favorable stock assessment into an allocation and how that triggers back to sectors in the common pool, I think we've done our job here, unless I'm missing something. The science side and the loading of new information is a separate but equally important process. And if I've mischaracterized anything, Tom's going to tell me.
Well, I guess I'm a little concerned about this, that somehow ACE is going to appear, right? But there will, I know, but I'm a little concerned that ACE is going to appear somewhere. I mean, we've got a mortality objective right now, which says we want to get mortality as close to zero as possible. We've included provisions in this amendment that say we're not going, or potentially including provisions in this amendment that say we're not going to have any retention of Southern New England winter flounder, either by sector vessels or by common pool vessels. You heard advice from the SSC, which I won't quote exactly correctly, but they basically said, you know, the ABC for this stock should be based on some level of discards with discards rate declining over time, which is going to be difficult to do with a discard fishery and with a hopefully recovering stock. You know, we are going to no doubt see within a few years the discards increase. And then the question is going to come down to the council, you know, can we afford to transfer some of those discards into landings rather than just be wasteful? But the thing that I'm really getting at is that all of those things are interrelated, and I'm not sure that any of them we can look at and say, okay, right now, at some point, we're automatically going to be allowed to authorize ACE. I mean, if the amendment goes forward as it is now, at some point anyway, we're going to have to say possession through a management action that landing is allowed, if nothing else, before we can start giving ACE to somebody. And so that is going to take some kind of management action down the road by itself, unless we were to put in a trigger, which I'm not suggesting because we haven't designed it. And then you have to wrestle with the issue that, okay, and this is, you talked about rolling the SSC in, you know, at some point you're going to have to get SSC advice that bases the ABC on something other than just some presumed level of discards.
Right. The framework language in the main motion is probably the most likely way that the change in landing prohibition for common pool and sectors would occur. I think the amendment just states for the record that the allocation period, whatever it is, applies to this stock. Dave Preble.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I strongly support this this amendment. I think that it's likely that it would be automatically done this way, but I think it needs to be stated. I think it needs to be stated for the benefit of industry that that needs to be certain in their minds that this is exactly how it will be done. So I support it. Thank you.
Anyone wishing to speak against the motion to amend? Okay, ready for the question? The motion to amend. All those in favor, raise your hand. Seventeen, unanimous. Back on the main motion as amended, Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, I'd like to follow up on this 20% cap. A number of people in the audience expressed concern about that cap, removing the cap. I don't recall anyone speaking to the issue at the public hearing in Wakefield. Then again, there weren't many people at the public hearing in Wakefield, except some familiar faces. And by the way, that was a great disappointment to me. I think the public participation at all the public hearings was dismal, to say the least, and somewhat of a surprise in light of the significance of this amendment. Anyways, with that said, I guess my first question would be to Tom relative to this cap. Is there any analyses in the amendment that would give us any indication of the consequences of removing the 20% cap, especially relative to the objectives that we have set for ourselves for sectors?
Well, I'll be up front. I don't think there's any real detailed analysis of removing the 20% cap.
Okay, there is no analyses, at least no detailed analyses, and that troubles me because I do believe that by removing the cap, it does provide sectors with the unlimited ability to capture all of a particular ACE or the majority of a particular ACE, and that's very uncomfortable to me, especially in the context of impacts on the different coastal communities up and down the coast. So with that said, because there is nothing in the amendment that makes a compelling case for removing the cap, I would move that we retain the 20% cap on TAC shares established in Amendment 13.
Is there a second? Seconded by Jim Fair. Discussion on the motion to amend. Jim Odlin.
Yeah, I'm opposed to this motion. The council itself voted to remove the cap quite a while back. And the second issue is the practicality of it. All you're doing is saying that if somebody's going to hit 20%, they just have to split up their sector. It can be the same manager, same operations plan practically. It's just impractical. They can, we've already got 17 sectors, 18, 20 sectors. Do we want another 10 because somebody might hit a cap on a particular item? I think that's why the council voted to take it out in the first place, so that it's just it doesn't accomplish anything by having it there. It's just because of the reasons I stated. If somebody just splits their sector in half, same managers, you're just asking them to file another tax return in a year. So, and there's nothing to prevent ACE from being traded from any sectors. So do you want to make sure that nobody can trade over 20%? I mean, that's a different issue. So I'm opposed to the motion. Thank you.
Dave Gable.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether I'm for or opposed, but we don't have the information to make this decision. This has been part and parcel of the problem with where we've been going from day one here. We get the landings history after we make up the options. People don't know how much they're bringing to the sectors. We don't know who's joining the sectors yet. We still don't know whether 20% is too much, too little. I just don't know how to vote. I don't want to put a cap on a sector and find out that it means you've got to throw people out that have signed up to join it. That's one concern. I understand why there's no analysis because, you know, this is it's a cart and a horse here, and we can't figure out who's pulling who yet. We, you know, maybe by the end of the day we'll know, and maybe at that point we can make motions to reconsider or something in light of how the allocation goes down. But right now we still don't know what allocation formula is going to be used, so we don't know who's getting what. So I guess I'd have to oppose it, at least at this time.
Anyone wishing to speak in favor of the motion on the council? I'll go to the audience. In favor of the motion? Opposed? Maggie?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I would say that possibly the reason why there may have been no public comment on this issue was because the public assumed that the council had already made its decision on this issue a long time ago. As far as analysis in the document, I would say that there was no detailed analysis in Amendment 13 for imposing a cap to begin with. Dave Gable just made some of the arguments that I made. I mean, we submitted a proposal to the council over 2 years ago for a sector. At that time, there was a cap. We were asking to be exempt for that for one or two species. And then the council made a decision several months ago to remove the cap. And so we have formed our sector on that basis. As David Gable said, that if a cap is now imposed, we would have to exclude people from our sector. And we've been very careful about the we have a lot of people who are still asking us to join our sector, and we have closed the roster. Anyway, this would have a huge impact on our sector if this cap was reinstated now, and I'm not sure how we would deal with that. So I would ask you to vote against this amendment. Thank you.
Anyone in the audience in favor of the motion? Eric?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Eric Anderson. Yeah, I think there's been some valid points from either from a variety of comments here. I think the only thing that's in question is whether it's the right number. I think conceptually it has merit, because I don't know that anybody can forecast the ramifications of somebody potentially acquiring 100% of of a TAC. We're just too new at the table in this discussion. If in years down the road you see this develop and you see that it has, you know, you've created an issue that's creating a problem and all the financial consequences that come across or that are associated with it, at least you have the time to avoid it right now. The number, I think the concept is correct. The number might be wrong. That's all. And if it can't be expressed in this type of motion and in this type of motion with a correct number, you can at least maybe make some adjustment to what you believe the correct concept should be.
Okay, back to the council. Doug Grout.
Just to ask some of the people that were here in Amendment 13 when that 20% cap was put in, was there any specific basis on which that 20% was developed? Anybody recall?
Jimmy?
Yeah, I recall it was the projected share that they were, of ACE that the sector that was formed in 13 was going to have. That's all.
Anything further from the council? Ready for the question? On the motion to amend, all those in favor, raise your hand. Two. Opposed? Thirteen. Abstentions? One abstention. Motion to amend fails 2-13 with one abstention. Back on the main motion as amended. Anything further on the main motion as amended? Give you a second to refresh your memories as to what that is. Everybody comfortable? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Sixteen. Opposed? One. Motion carries 16-1. Rip.
We move on to the sector baseline calculations, section 4.3.3.3.4. Comments, Tom?
I'm going to take perhaps a little more time describing this one than I described some of the earlier alternatives. Potential sector contributions are nothing more than what each permit brings into a sector. It's in terms of a percentage of the available catch that will be harvested in a given year. It does not turn into pounds of fish until it comes into the sector where it gets all the participants' potential sector contributions get summed up and get converted into annual catch entitlement or ACE. The amendment proposes to change the way these potential sector contributions are calculated. Most people throughout the discussions of public hearings and throughout our discussions over the years don't bother using the term PSC. They just use the term permit history. So if I flip-flop back and forth, that's why. The alternatives are described in the amendment, but to run through them for a minute, the no-action alternative is based on landings history alone, and it's the most recent 5 years. Most recent is in quotes because there are some data lags, and the most recent year is typically not the year just before you want to operate. It's at least a year or two before that, depending on when the data becomes available. This is a rolling period. It would change if a sector forms in the future from the way people are operating now. Alternative one to this is based on landings history alone, and it uses the time period fishing year 96 to fishing year 2006. Alternative 2 in the amendment document and Alternative 3 use a combination of landings history and what's referred to as a capacity formula. The capacity formula in each option considers a vessel's length, horsepower, and allocated category A days at sea. It combines them in a formula. And the landings history share and the capacity share are averaged together. The formulas are basically calculated the same way in each option, alternative 2 and 3. However, they're applied differently. In alternative 2, the formula is calculated and it only applies to the stocks caught by the permit. So if you caught Gulf of Maine cod, you get a permit history or PSC for Gulf of Maine cod. If you never caught a southern New England yellowtail flounder, you would not get a southern New England yellowtail flounder quota. It would be zero under this alternative. In alternative three, however, they use the same formula, and it's applied to all stocks that are allocated. So regardless of what you are, regardless of what you landed in the past, you get an allocation of all stocks. And so in alternative three, to use my example, the boat that never landed a southern New England winter flounder or yellowtail flounder would get some allocation of southern New England winter or yellowtail flounder. Alternative four is based on landings history and framework 42 allocated category A days at sea. That A days replaces the capacity part of the formula in alternatives two and three. And alternative four applies to all stocks. There's a fifth alternative that is separate from these and is not shown on the board. The fifth alternative would use the Amendment 13 approach for the boats that were permits that were committed to the two existing sectors for Georges Bank Cod alone. Basically, their allocation would be based on fishing year 96 to 2001 landings history alone. And once it was calculated for that permit, it would stay with that permit even if that permit went to some other sector, that calculation. For any other stock, it would be calculated for those permits based on whichever alternative the council chooses. Now, just to make sure people understand, the plan here is to do this calculation once, as much as possible. And there are some language in the amendment that talks about, you know, what is the date that's used, what's the date for determining your length and horsepower, what's the date for determining the permits that get this alternative five applied to them, what's the date for the pool of permits that are eligible for sector participation. All of that's spelled out in the amendment. And the concept, anyway, is that once these PSCs are calculated for permits, then the service doesn't have to do that again in the future. It only gets done once. So it will be done for everybody in the fishery, regardless of whether they choose to join a sector or not, and that will be attached to the permit. The amendment also recognizes, however, and we've tried to make this very clear at the public hearings and through all our documents and discussions, that, you know, the existing council members can't bind the hands of a future council. And so we would like to hope that if we choose one of these alternatives, it will guide any future allocation decisions of the council. The reality is we can't really guarantee that. You know, it's possible that some future council down the road may decide that the allocation should be made in some different way.
We received a lot of comments about the potential sector contribution calculation, and I'm not sure that everyone can see this, but I have the tally up here of how many people supported each option. By far, the most popular option was number one. We had 34 letters of comment in support of that option, and two people opposed to it. That's the history only from 1996 to 2006 option. Options three and four, I guess, got the most opposition. Option two had 11 people supporting it and one person opposing it. There were a lot of comments about the history-setting process. A lot of people said that they didn't get the letters from the agency that detailed their own history in time to make a decision about which alternative they preferred to make a comment. A lot of people commented that they would need to know the actual numbers that they'd be receiving as part of the Sector ACE rather than just the percentage, which is what they received in the mail. A lot of people, and particularly people that supported option one, were in favor of using the longest time frame possible, so including the years 2007 and 2008 if it were to be available. We had several comments, probably about 40 comments, to freeze the baseline. Some people supported a dynamic baseline. There were a lot of comments about people's individual histories that they were either missing or incorrect. We had a handful of comments that rebuilt stocks such as Gulf of Maine haddock and redfish should be spread out so that everyone could benefit from the stocks that have been rebuilt, and that the allocation of those should be spread out. Some people were against using years for the allocation where you had differing trip limits in southern New England and in Gulf of Maine and Georges Bank. Several people thought that the years should be the same between all sectors and for the recreational and commercial allocations, whichever set of years were chosen, they thought it was important that those would match. That's it.
There was a substantial discussion on this at the Groundfish AP meeting, and the AP supported option one, which was the landing history only. Okay. On behalf of the committee, I move that the council approves PSC option one, fishing year 96 through 2007, and note the modified year, and option five combined. That passed the committee 6-4-3 against, one abstention.
Okay, that's a committee motion. I'm going to rule that motion out of order because it contains the year 2007. My purview as chair on this specific decision alone, I think I seriously think we need to stick within the bounds of what was analyzed in the document, what was taken out the public hearing. I don't think the public nor the council have a reasonable expectation of the inclusion of this year in an alternative. This is a critical issue, and we don't have analysis in front of us to understand what the pluses and minuses would be of adding a year onto this alternative or this option. So in my view, it's out of order. Terry Stockwell.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. That being said, I'm going to move that the council approve option one with a 96 to 2006 timeline and option five combined.
Seconded by Dave Preble.
And my rationale for this is option one was supported by the majority of the public comments. It was supported by the advisory panel. It was supported by the committee. And option five was supported by the committee to provide stability for the existing sectors.
Okay, we now have a workable motion on the board. I'm going to go to the audience. Those in favor? Mr. Libby?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Glenn Libby, Port Clyde. I just have to say our sector did vote for option two, but option one they would accept as well. And I would also support the option five inclusion. Thank you.
Members in the audience against? Rich, you're neutral? All right, we'll create a classification for neutral comments. Neutral canastra.
I've always been told I have to be different, but I just want to clarify, being on the advisory committee for the groundfish, at that meeting, I abstained, and there's five of us that abstained from a vote as far as which allocation is going to go forward. Personally, it doesn't matter to me. I abstained because I'm not a vessel owner. I leave it to the industry. But what bothered me is that at the advisory committee, we're asked to give a consensus of where we're going, while that night was the first public hearing. So talk about putting the horse before the cart, or the cart before the horse. I was a bit confused, but I want to make it known that five abstained and there wasn't a consensus. In my opinion.
Those against? Eric?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not saying that I'm against it, but prior to the fact that you're going to take these allocation issues separately through the user groups, I think there's just a general comment that I think is needed from a point of opinion or, you know, consciousness to the council. Right here in this particular motion, you have taken, and from an allocation point of view, because here it is, here's where the pie is on the table and it's getting sliced. And that's the issue that you're going to take up very, you know, with going through the user groups. And what I think is what I think and had always hoped out of this discussion is that it would be consistent. And there'd be consistency across the user groups. Right here, represented in this particular option, we have one sector or one user group with two different allocation options. So you're slicing the pie differently in a manner. And as you approach the next group, you know, user group, there'll be another set of circumstances. So within the user groups classified as commercial and recreational, and you haven't got to that yet, you will have two different allocation time frames. So there's no consistency across the board. I'm not particularly concerned. I know I don't have a favor for one option. I do have a favor for one option over the other, but I'll reserve that. The issue is there's some fundamental incorrectness in using different time frames and standards, at least from somebody's perception of national standards. I mean, this is a heavy subject here. Here's probably the heaviest load you're going to probably bear today when you start slicing this pie. And it's only for the fact that there's concern that it has, you know, ramifications for everybody. There's no question about that. And that you've used different criteria and different time frames to slice the pie for different user groups. And I think that should be a major concern. I don't have any clue of the legality of it, but just on the front face of fairness and equity, I think there's an issue here. And proceed as you may, but at least I think it's worth the message that's trying to be conveyed here. Thank you.
In favor? John?
John Howard Chatham, 28 years in the business, owner, member of the fixed gear sector. I'm in support of option 1 and 5. I'm adamantly opposed against option 2 and the 50-50 and all that. That's just a shot across the bow at the small boats that'll ruin Chatham. And I'd just like to say I want to be treated the same way today and the same way in the future. And I don't want the allocations to change because I want to keep it as a business plan, and I'm surviving at that. If you do it any other way, you're going to destroy the small boat to Chatham. Thank you.
Against? Mr. Kalin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jeff Kalin, representing Lund's Fisheries, and I've also been asked to speak for Greg DiDomenico at the Garden State Seafood Association. We're also members of the Garden State Seafood Association opposing the motion. We think that we were supported option 2. We think that it's important to establish these allocations not based solely on landings history, because in the Mid-Atlantic, when days were initially allocated, we were essentially forced to lease them to other fishermen because there weren't that many days. And while these leases have been beneficial for us and also the New England fishermen that they were leased to generally, we think it's unfair to use recent catch histories to allocate PSC, since landings stemming from the lease permits accrued to the persons fishing the days and diminished the value of the permits that were held originally. And we think that the allocation formula in option 2 creates an opportunity to rectify this. And this situation, we think, was anticipated in Amendment 3. There was language that talked about allowing vessels that own the days at sea to retain the history of the days at sea would alleviate the concern that leasing those days will affect future decisions like this one today. So we're opposed to a straight history calculation, and we're also opposed to option 5 because we think that all these sectors today going forward should be established based on the same allocation scheme. And so we're opposed to the motion. I know we're going to get toasted here, but we're still opposed to it. Thank you.
In favor? Eric?
Eric Hess, member of the hook sector. I'm in favor of the motion, obviously. We sort of stepped out 5 years ago and tried to create this concept in a way that would keep us in the fishery. We've had some success. At times, I think it's been almost overblown, and people have reacted unfavorably to that. We've had trouble catching our cod, even with the advantages of the sector, but I think that's more a resource issue. We didn't have other sectors to lease our quota to or any of the other advantages that are being proposed that give flexibility to the sectors that are being proposed. I guess my point is that if you're contemplating being in a sector, I think you should pause for a minute and think, well, gee, you know, what happens if I lease my quota out? If you don't approve this option 5, then you're sort of open the door and set a precedent that future allocations could change. So if you elect not to fish as part of your sector and instead lease your quota out to another member of the same sector or a different sector, then the next time around, you could potentially lose all of your allocation, and then, you know, you'd have to buy it back. That's basically what we're looking at as part of the existing sectors. We have sort of operated in this microcosm, which has paved the way and for a lot of the questions and answers that have been worked out for these sectors. But as individuals, we've all bought and sold and tried to stay abreast of what it would take to remain in the industry. And the quotas that we've established in the existing sectors, I feel, should be held to the same standard that you would want your own quota to be held to down the road. In other words, you don't want it to change because you're sick for a year and you weren't able to catch it, or you know, you decided to lease it to someone else for the year and you didn't catch it yourself. You wouldn't want your sector contribution to change, and we don't either. So I support the motion that's up there now. Thank you.
Against? Steve?
Steve Welch, commercial fisherman. I'm not here to speak against it. I don't even know if I'm in favor for it. I will tell you that I'm very confused with the sector process. There's a lot of things that came down on us in the last couple of months. And we're here today. In my eyes, the one thing I understand is this is an allocation issue. And if we're going to start allocating the resource, I want to be treated fairly like John Auer. Eric Anderson made some great points, too. But I would say that we really need to have a broad timeline from 96 to 2006 for all fishermen and for all categories of fishermen, be it charter or commercial or recreational. I myself, I would be better off choosing a timeline from 96 to 2001 for Georges Bancroft, because I fished down Chatham along with a lot of your guys, and I have a great history down there then. So I would like that for me. But consequently, when I go up into the Gulf of Maine, I would like to choose the years from what the recreational people are going for is 96 back to 2001 to 2006, because I would be much better off having those landings for Gulf of Maine cod. Because it's an allocation issue, we've all been in the industry a long time, I think it's fair just to use the years 96 to 2006 when we allocate the resources for everybody in the industry, and then there won't be any questions and there won't be any hard feelings. So I don't know if I'm for or against it, but if you're going to allow me to use 96 to 2001 for Georges Bancroft, I'm fine with that. But if you're going to disqualify me because I didn't belong to a sector at that time, then I have a problem with that. And the same for the other years in the Gulf of Maine. Thank you.
Four.
No.
Allison.
Allison Jordan, fishing vessel, Jamie and Ashley, and Teresa and Allison. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with the recommendation that Terry made for approving option 5 and option the 100% history, years 96 to 2006. It's the only fair way to do this. The people that are in the industry, the groundfish industry that did not leave the industry, has put time, money, we've followed the regulations and rules, and we are barely surviving. So our history, we worked for, and we need our history. So thank you, and I hope you approve it.
Against? Chris Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chris Brown, Rhode Island Commercial Fishermen Association. I am opposed to purely historical allocation. I'll get to the species, I guess, right off the bat. Codfish. I'll use my personal history. I've fished for 30 years in southern New England exclusively. I have never left the area. 33,000-plus tows in and around Block Island within 10 miles. The 10-year frame of history, I have roughly 69,000 codfish. In the 5-year frame of history, I have roughly 69,000 codfish. And in the 2-year history, I have roughly 69,000 codfish. Looking in the last couple of years. We have a wonderful codfish recovery occurring in southern New England. The 10 years that you've picked to allocate from will exclude all of southern New England from a once rich traditional fishery. The only possible way to offset historical allocation excluding us would be to consider a portion of the Georges Bank cod be set aside annually for evaluation to see if the stock has come up somewhere else. There really is a wonderful event going on down there. It's not all bad news. Dr. Steve Cadron was aboard the fishing vessel Isabella Rose in the winter of 2007 and documented an ongoing spawn south of Cox's Ledge. A lot of fish, a lot of big fish. Now we have a lot of juvenile fish. Historical allocation may seem like the way to go for the average guy in the short term. Everyone's looking at getting by in the very, very short term, and I understand that. But it does raise a bunch of problems that we haven't addressed. Stock shift is one of them. I don't think we even had enough time to discuss what is a proper allocation formula. I think 75 and 25 is better. I don't have any hopes of popping that one on the table and running with it too far today, but we didn't have enough time to discuss it. Pure historical allocation may provide you strength in day one. It will be that which weakens you should the stock assessment fail. If you are purely dependent on cod, if you were a cod runner, God bless you. You did what you had to do. But you're one stock assessment away from being out of business. There's a lot of things to be said for diversity. Take it from a guy who did all he could do to not buy all the Enron stock he could get his hands on, and was only stopped by my broker. I guess overall, I'm just opposed to it for the potential consequences it could hold down the road for everybody, and that truly it disfavors the larger vessels. I have a small vessel, and I have rich history, but I recognize this as being unfair to the larger vessels because in the last 10 years, everything has been a response to management. It has been, you know, you get out and get your limit of this, your limit of that, your limit of this. It does not ever take into consideration someone who bought a 90-foot boat with 800-900 horsepower and had his wings clipped. 10 years prior to this, the allocation would have looked entirely different. So for those reasons, I am opposed to purely historical allocation, unless you can some way find a way to accommodate stock shift, enormous stock shift, like that which we are occurring in southern New England right now. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Speaking for the motion. For the motion. David.
Yes, thank you. Dave Marciano. Gloucester Gillnetter. I'm speaking for the motion only because given the options before us, it suits my, I won't even call it needs. I mean, sectors is a death sentence for me and my family. We know that from day one. There's a lot of unanswered. This really is no, the comments have come up. There's no fair way to do this. We had Kessler's ruling stripped away 100% access to Haddock for the Gillnet fleet. We were denied access for all the years since that. I tried with my best efforts participating in all the meetings and all due process to try and get that fishery back. And we never got a shot to participate in a fully rebuilt fishery once a federal judge stripped access away. You know, that being said, we know what it means when we go to sectors and we get our allocation. It's not about being inclusive and people keeping people and families in their homes and in the business. It's about kicking families out the street, because just because of the cost of operating in a sector, you're not going to be a viable business. It strips away, you know, 50% of your operating costs now become paying for, you know, operating in the sector. You know, it's insanity. It's going to, we're going to wind up losing the home and the boat over this. But, you know, that being said, you never had options created that address all these unfairness issues. So we're stuck with a bunch of bad choices. And even this is a bad choice. This left me with the choice to support this motion. My option is to, you know, cut my son's throat or cut my best friend's throat, which is what I had to decide to do. Thanks.
Against? Aaron?
Aaron Doherty, Penobscot East Resource Center in Stonington, Maine. We are opposed to this option, and I want to clarify, we're not opposed to the piece that Cape Cod would keep their allocation. I think, you know, that makes a lot of sense. But to go with straight catch history is probably the least equitable option for a lot of fishermen throughout New England, and affects not only fishermen but entire fishing communities. The area that I'm from, I'm representing 24 fishermen with limited access permits between Penobscot Bay and Canada, and the groundfish stocks in that region have been depleted for a long time. Fishermen haven't been able to fish during the 1996 to 06 years. Most of them stopped, you know, in the early 90s. Some of them continued to fish until the late 90s. But the reality is that those fishermen have very little catch history. Looking at the other options, they have very little days at sea as well, so that doesn't necessarily help. But I think that we need to take into consideration some of the comments that have come from others before me here, the concerns that were raised about going with straight catch history, as well as this. I mean, looking at entire communities that no longer have a place in the fishery, whether it's communities on Long Island that lost access to flounders, or whether it's eastern Maine communities that lost access to a lot of groundfish stocks, I know there are others that share the story as well. So while I don't expect this to be changed today, I do urge this council to take a hard look at this issue and to think about alternative ways that we can mitigate some of those concerns for these communities, whether it's through a community fishing association that this council may be able to take up in this amendment, or whether it's through future regulatory actions in Amendment 17. But I do sincerely hope that you don't forget about those communities that are left out in this allocation process. Thank you.
Four. Gary.
Gary Libby, Port Clyde. First, I want to thank you for declaring 07 out of order, because we didn't, if for all the reasons you've stated, we don't even know what 07 holds for us. So thanks for that. I'm for the option. We discussed it with our group, and option two would have been okay too, but option one, I know, I see why this motion was made, because this was the preferred option in the hearings. And as far as option five goes, that has to be in there because of the existing sectors, and they need to keep operating as they have for years. So I'm going to give this motion yes. Thank you.
Against? Russell?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Russell Sherman, commercial fisherman. The way I feel on this is that, well, in reality, I'm out of business. This is it. I've already told the crew May 1st, 2010, she's tied up. That's the way it goes, and that's the way of it. And I feel that anyone that has a single permit probably will be in my shoes as well, or a good many of us. That being said, I believe option two for me would have been better, although none of the four would save me. But I am directly opposed to this tacking on number five onto option number one, because I would have done a lot better if it wasn't for the judgment of Judge Kessler, whom, after I had just purchased the vessel and gone on the hook for a couple hundred grand at my age, she and the people who joined in, Cape Cod Hook, who are now crying now, put me down to 31 days for 2 years in a row. Nobody seemed to worry about it then. I'm taking my lumps. I'm going out of business. I think everyone should be treated the same way. I don't think that we should make a special thing for the fellas down there in that hook sector. They joined it of their own free will. I bought my vessel out of New Jersey, and I bought it out of my own free will, and it turned out to be a bad deal. I'm accepting that. I'm going out of business, finest kind, after 40 years in this business. But to give someone a preference over other folks, they can pick and choose the years that they want, I think that's totally wrong, because I'd like to pick and choose my years as well, but I'm not going to. So I think, all right, option one, another thing about option one is you're rewarding the people who have done the most business, the most damage, and I think it's very incongruous for people to back and say, we want to save the small boat fishermen, we want to save the fishing communities, and yet work directly against it, to work politically directly against it, and also give the folks who've done the most damage the biggest reward. I think it's wrong. But it's not as wrong as combining this amendment, this fifth option, puts somebody in a different class than the rest of us. And I don't think that's right. If you're going to screw us all equally. Thank you.
Four. Paul.
Paul Parker, Cape Cod Commercial Hook Fishermen's Association. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this motion is very important for the fishery, obviously. The first part of it, option one, is distributing the allocation based on who's been catching the fish over the past 10 years. Those are the people that are most reliant on this fishery at this time. And I understand that there's a lot of people that would look towards this fishery in the future. But I think what we really need to be focused on is how low these TACs are and how little room there is in this groundfish fishery. The second part of the motion talks about how we're going to treat the two existing sectors. But the reason why so many people in this audience and so many people in their comments favor option five, as well as concepts like freezing history moving forward, is that people that decide to go into these sectors need to know that they're going to have stability in the future. There isn't anybody in this room that won't have to recapitalize their business and make investments in order to survive Amendment 16. And what Option 5 does is set the stage for the future of this fishery and allow people that decide to take their business and put it into a sector in Amendment 16 to know that their interests are going to be taken care of in the future. And so I understand that there's people in the audience that think it's unfair. But everybody in this audience is going to want to know, moving forward under Amendment 16 and under a new template of sectors, which permits should be purchased in order to make their businesses whole and solvent again. I'll just say, you know, on the record, when you look at catch history, what types of quotas you're looking at for Georges Bank cod stock. I think there's a perception that somebody's getting away with something anywhere. And I've looked at putting permits into a calculator, and anybody that's done that knows that there's nobody that's escaping this amendment. 100,000 pounds of codfish history over that 10-year window makes about 5,000 to 7,000 pounds of quota for somebody in one of these sectors next year. There's nobody that's unscathed. So there's nobody in this audience clapping their hands at the end of this motion. And it's a hard one, but we need to go with a motion that creates stability for the future of our fleet. Thank you.
Against? Joe?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for the record, I've been fishing for 35 years, well, my whole life. And I'm against this motion. I believe that we all should be treated equally. And really, but reality is that we're really not. I'm a multiple permit holder, okay? And I bought three additional permits with my original one. Four permits. One permit was a C permit, which I transferred so I can use my additional days. My other two permits I bought only qualified. They qualified under Amendment 13, but 1 year. I've invested over $300,000 with four permits. I'm going to go out of business under this stuff that's going on right now, this allocation thing. Four permits that you told me to go buy and do. Who's going to be liable for that? Who's going to pay my $300,000 and I'm going to be out on? I pulled my house out for the last permit I bought. You talk about fairness, and then some people want to be more, you know, well, we're going to lose. We're going to lose it all with four permits. Talk about fairness. And you told me to go do it. And Phil Coates left in 2000. And he used to tell us all the time, boys, get off of ground fish and go do something else. And the people that stayed in and pounded the shit out of the fishery are going to get rewarded. How do you justify that? Thank you.
Four. Stu.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Stu Tolley, Georges Bank Fixed Gear Sector. I'm in favor of Motion 1 and 5. Let's see. One of the big reasons I'm in favor of history is because it takes your year-round fishermen. They've been fishing for decades. Like a lot of our group, they've been fishing 10, 20, 30, even 40 years. And most of them are all year-round fishermen. And I feel that the capture, you know, what they've done with the history is the best way. With our sector right now, if I take options 2, 3, or 4, what's going to happen is we're going to lose 40% of our allocation just by going with either one of those three options. This current year right now, our sectors have had their cod allocation reduced by 60%. Through a lowering of NIMS cod tack for Georges Bank. So that's 60% we've got already cut off this year. Now you add another 40% removal of that allocation with options 2, 3, and 4. And then in 2010, I believe I heard, there's going to be another reduction of 25 to maybe 40% of Georges Bank cod. And majority of our people, they're going to be out of business. And you know, I just, like I said, I, you know, for us, I know it's not for everybody. A lot of people are going to get hurt and go out of business. But I think the fairest way to go is with history. Thank you.
Against, Jim Kendall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim Kendall, New Bedford Seafood Consulting. I want to make it clear that I'm speaking for myself on this issue, but, you know, I was in the fishery for quite a while. Most of my history is what you probably call prehistoric. I was out of the fishery in 1994 because of an injury. I was cut loose. So I can appreciate what some of these people are facing. A little earlier on, you heard a statement about we need to protect those who are most dependent on this, on these fisheries. Well, who the hell is that? Who's most dependent, and who's going to decide who's most dependent? Who's going to kick that last person out of the lifeboat? I've never been able to accept that concept that someone who is not intimately involved other than management or part of the process or part of the suffering that's gone on is the one to make the decision about who stays and who must go. To me, that's always been the toughest thing to try and decide, to play God. Now, I've been relatively silent about this sector issue, but I'm pretty much philosophically opposed to it for several reasons. And that's why I'm opposed to this option, because I think all of these options have not been well enough defined to be the final cutting line for who's going to stay and who's going to go. Once this is drawn up and once this is done, there's no turning back for pretty much all these people unless they completely revamp the whole process. The issue has been that sectors get you out of days at sea. That's much like days at sea got us out of the meat count in scalloping. That isn't what saves scalloping, but a lot of people are hoping that this will be the same type of situation that will eventually do that, because no one is doing well under days at sea. So it's basically a false hope, a false premise, and something I don't think can be accomplished. When a man is overboard and drowning, he will reach for anything that's thrown to him, and I think you're throwing him an anchor. And in his desperation, he's willing to grab for it. And to me, that's the wrong way to put this out. You've heard so many different issues about who should stay, who should go, who's going to be able to stay and go, that it has to show you that there are so many questions that remain unresolved that they shouldn't go forward, like I say, with the false hope and the false premise that it is. Basically, it's ITQs or IFQs or allocation, no matter how you want to look at it. And as far as I'm concerned, it's just circumventing the referendum that was put into Magnuson to protect this industry, or this part of the nation, from going ahead without this, without getting a full approval of the people that participate, other than the people who are on the outside managing. Thank you.
In favor? Ted?
Hook fisherman. I'm a jig fisherman, about the last one left. I've been speaking for Amendment 5 there, or whatever it's called, Option 5. Ever since I started going to council meetings about, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago, he'd go out to lunch with the guys and he'd always say, well, Jack's not going to like that because it's going to put him out of business. And it's been going on like this ever since. Guys are going in and out of business by decisions that are made here and there, luncheons, backdoor meetings, the council meetings. And so we're trying to get this sector thing to work. So we got these first two sectors, and they want to keep their initial history that they started the sector with, that we planned our future with, that I plan my future with, because if we don't have Amendment 5, I'll go out of business, so, you know, whatever, because I can't catch many fish with a hand line with the 22-inch limit, which, you know, is not at all serious. Everybody's going through a lot of pain. But the fact of the matter is, if you set a precedent so that what a sector gets, it keeps, then we won't have to, and if the sector experiment works, then you won't have to fight all the time. And that's why you would probably want to accept option five, because that would give a way for the sector experiment to work. Because it's not going to work if we're going to fight all the time, on and on. You keep on changing stuff around all the time. Actually, if I knew when I joined the sector how it was going to go, I probably would have bought some licenses. I don't have a real lot of money at hand, but I would have bought some licenses, but I didn't know what to buy. So, you know, I didn't. But in any case, you have to know where you're coming from and where you're going to be in business. And that's why I'm in favor of option five.
Rich, against? Or is this another neutral comment?
I'll figure it out when I get there.
Keeping me in suspense.
Rich Canastra, I'm speaking on behalf of the Mayor's Ocean and Fisheries Council in New Bedford. As far as option one and five, I think they should be separately voted on, not together as a package. But it's going back to the meeting, you got to realize that we're talking about fairness. Am I better than any one of you? Thank you, Rodney. No, it's just fairness. You know, we're talking about allocation here. It's fairness. One of the people mentioned in the sector that, well, if we're sick and we can't fish, we'll still get what we can get as far as our allocation. But you got to remember, days at sea, people were leasing, and the boats that were leasing did not obtain history and went to the leaser. So they're in the same scenario right now. But all I can really say, it's fairness. You be the judge. You're judging it today. Good, evil. It's fairness. Just keep that in your mind.
Still trying to figure out if that was...
And bicycle.
All right. So I guess... Against? Joel? I'm going to take one more against and one more for, if there is one, and then I'm going to bring it back to the council.
I have to bring this with me because I can't remember everything that I want to say, but I'm going to quote some of the things that Jim Rule said when he was in Washington. We're getting to the point here where the rubber meets the road. And basically, the question that he was asking when he was in Washington was whether or not the Congress of the United States ever intended for us to be at the point that we're at now. And I think that the answer to that question is no, because clearly the way that we're operating today is still dysfunctional. Okay? Another question that he asked was whether or not the United States wants to be a seafood producing nation. And what we're doing now is relegating ourselves to a minor role in the production of our seafood based on science that we all know is very skeptical. And this has been what I've been, my biggest bitch about this whole thing right from the get-go, is that we're going to end up putting people out of business based on poor science. And is that fair to anyone? If anyone can answer that question and go to sleep tonight with a clear conscience to say, yeah, based on the science that we use today, we know we're going to put people out of business, no problem, and shame on you. But that being said, I'm just going to give you a little quote here from what he said. Since 1976, when Magnuson-Stevens became the framework for managing the United States fisheries, nearly two-thirds of the commercial fishing fleet and the infrastructure has vanished. two-thirds already that we've lost. Now, that number could be questionable, but there's no one that will say that a significant portion of this industry has not already been lost, okay? The infrastructure has vanished. Seafood imports have tripled. We're importing 85% of the seafood that we consume in this country. And we have the environmental organizations all here trying to put the foot on our throats and pass all this off to third world nations who have no regulations, and they're going to pass it off to those people. We're operating under systems that are sound and that work. We tow the largest mesh in the world to try to save the fish. The fishermen are conscientious about saving the fish and doing the right thing. Yet we're willing to sit here and let them pass this off to other portions of the world and the oceans and let them destroy that over there while we've already saved this? This is insanity. And last but not least, the number of NMFS employees has quadrupled. So I would submit to you that what this industry has become is just a vehicle for more government, larger government, and more taxpayer waste. And that's all it amounts to. Thank you very much.
Four. Maggie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maggie Raymond, Associated Fisheries of Maine. For about 18 months now, we've been asking for some rationale for these options that are based on something other than catch history, and I'm still waiting for an answer to that. I don't see anything in the document that provides any rationale for why the council would stray from a general policy of allocating based on catch history. It's consistent with how allocations are made in most fisheries around this country and around the world, and it's consistent with your most recent allocation decision for the general category fishery, which was based on history of landings. And in fact, you gave extra credit to people for the length of time that they were involved in the fishery. So you acknowledged that their dependence on the fishery was an issue in that decision making. We think that this that option one is the least disruptive, and acknowledge that there is going to be major disruptions from the whole decision-making that is involved in Amendment 16. But in terms of the allocation, we believe that option one would be the least disruptive. I will point out again that the majority of public comments were in support of option one, and that the Groundfish Advisory Panel did take a position on this issue voted in favor of this option. In fact, the people who abstained. They had no position. So the people who did take a position all voted in favor of option one. So we urge you to support this motion. Again, because it was supported by the majority of comments, the advisory panel, and the committee. Thank you.
Against? Eric, you already spoke on this, didn't you, Eric?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Anyone who hasn't spoken on this, against? Yes, ma'am, in the back.
I'm Boyce Thorne-Miller from Northwest Atlantic Marine Alliance, and we're not opposed to number five, but we are opposed to option one. We don't believe it's fair to many of the communities around New England. You've heard from many of them already. And we also do not support two, three, and four. While we realize you will go ahead with one of these selections today, We hope that in the future you'll reconsider and come up with some better options, perhaps in the context of Amendment 17. Thank you.
One more. Four. Neutral? All right. Veto?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Vito Gigoloni, Northeast Seafood Coalition. If for nothing else, I felt compelled in representing 13 sectors to at least say something on the allocation and set it clear for the record that the coalition wanted to have alternatives on the table. We're thankful that the service responded favorably to getting information out to fishermen, which is what we wanted. We hope that all of us had come up with a manner in getting that out sooner. But I think we wanted an open and transparent process, and we wanted the permit holders to make the decision on this. So the coalition is totally indifferent to the allocation method. However, the only thing we can point out are the implications of the allocation and the total management scheme. As far as a reason for looking at the capacity, there is one primary reason to look at it. I will say that the alternatives on the table do not fix the concerns that we were looking for. So, and with the TACs as low as they are, it is a pick, you know, it's a triage thing at this point. There are a lot of people going down on this, and it's terrible. But there's a lack of ACL to work with, and this is a mathematical reality. But the common pool, this is unlike any other fishery that's been allocated. We are doing a dual system. And we can't forget that we're going to have a day at sea system that will have essentially zero quota allocated on a day at sea capacity basis. So we have had an amendment that's already looked at capacity. So we can't recognize that it doesn't exist. And we allocated that way. And now we're totally decoupling. We don't say that that's a bad thing or a good thing. We're just saying that it's the reality. And so you're going to have a common pool. And people, if I'm a guy with multiple permits in a sector, we know what's going to happen in the common pool. I'm going to support Eric Brazier earlier bringing up the point, do we have an accountability measure in the common pool? And I'm not going to be one here sitting here, I'm Mr. Sector Advocate, and let's kick the crap out of the common pool. We've already done that with the alternatives that we have. We've committed that common pool to failure, as far as I'm concerned, and we only make it worse when we say that, hey, if you got an extra permit that doesn't bring anything to the sector, let it kick ass in the common pool and participate in that while you're a sector member and double dip. So what I'm saying is no favor for which option is going down, and certainly we can do math, and we see what option one does for a full-time fisherman, and we recognize that with the alternatives that are on the table. But let's not allow this thing to be set up as a game. There's a legitimate reason why we're going to allocate days at sea, we're going to allocate length and horsepower, we're going to throw them in the common pool, and we're going to allow people to play in both games at the same time, with one is going to have accountability, and the other one, if there is none, then you just disband the permit, you let it enroll in a sector. I don't know what you do with it afterward. But I think as managers, we have to be mindful of the implications of once we do this, what a fisherman's reaction is going to be in the common pool. That's it.
Okay, I'm going to bring it back to the council. I think the most important thing I heard Vito say, he said a lot of important things, but there is not a lot of ACL to go around. We've got an ACL shortage situation, regardless of where you end up. Jim Odlin?
Yeah, because we've debated this at the committee for a long time, and I support the options that are up there. Option five, I understand a lot of the concerns people are having with that, but I think we want to, the rest of the industry will want to be treated the same way. This is only the codfish that they were allocated in Amendment 13. All the other stocks, they come under the same criteria as everybody else, the 96 through 2006. So I do think that option five is the fairest we can be to the existing sectors that have operated since Amendment 13. And as far as history only, I think we've done the best we can. We've gone back as far as we can. I would have preferred to go back farther, and I would have preferred to come more current. However, we didn't have accurate data to do that. And I think by picking the longest period possible, if we do that, each time we have to allocate something, we'll be a lot better off going forward. In the past, we've allocated based on history only in scallops. We just recently kicked a lot of people out of the herring industry based on history and some huge landings to qualify for Area 1A or the other ones. 1,000 tons, 500 tons. We didn't think anything of that. So, and then I look at the other options, option 2, 3, and 4, and I don't think people are realizing that there's a huge shift in those options. And the shift is from smaller vessels to larger vessels on the inshore stocks. On the Gulf of Maine cod, for instance, there will be a huge shift from smaller boats to larger boats. And that happens to be one of the stocks that has the most ace. And I think if we pick any of those options, we're going to see a move of larger boats into the inshore areas. And I don't think that's what we want to do. I think one of our goals was to try not to shake up the industry any more than necessary and preserve the makeup. So those are my concerns of the other options. It's clear in the document that you will have a shift. And I can tell you that the offshore boats will come inshore and catch more codfish and more yellowtails if they're allocated. They won't trade it. And to give inshore boats, 38-foot boats or 50-foot boats or 60-foot boats, offshore stocks of fish, it's not going to do them any good. They can't catch it. That's the reason they haven't caught it in the past. It can't happen. So I'm very comfortable with going with the option 1 and option 5 combined, and that'll be it.
Against? David?
Yeah. I think I'll start by reading National Standard 4. If it becomes necessary to allocate or assign fishing privileges among various U.S. fishermen, such allocation shall be fair and equitable to all such fishermen. And it is inherently unfair and inequitable to have one group get more, because that means another group gets less. So the baseline has to be the same for everybody. Commercial, recreational, existing sectors, you can't have different baselines because everybody's going to come to the table, which they just did. And like the cat that swallowed the canary, I'm surprised there weren't people choking on feathers. You know, they come up and said, give me the most. I don't blame them. Everybody wants the most. But if one person gets more, that means someone else gets less. And that is inherently unfair and a violation of National Standard 4. Are any of these options fair? No, they aren't, for a whole bunch of reasons. We've had leasing since 2003. People thought they were protecting their days by leasing them away after a judge stole them from them. But now they're going to get screwed because they leased the days away and somebody else is running off with the catch history. A few more feathers popping out. We've had SAPs, we've had B-days, we've had ways for some people to establish history and other people not to establish history. In the Gulf of Maine, we've had 30 pounds of cod a day. How much history are you going to establish on 30 pounds? Everything is inherently unfair. On the issue of the various options, I think if the industry had more time to think about it, they probably would pick a different option. Because what's the gold standard today could be GM tomorrow. You know, your options are all in cod or in yellowtail or whatever, one stock, two stocks, and all of a sudden those are the ones that get 10 pounds of ace for the year. You're going to be in trouble in the future. You'd be a lot better off with some of everything. Nevertheless, I understand that the industry overwhelmingly supports 1996 to 2006. For catch history. So I'm going to fold my tent on trying to help the industry, because I think the industry would be better off with another option if they thought about it over the long run. But I cannot abide by one group getting more, and that means other groups get less. And when we voted these things at the Groundfish Committee, this was the first vote, so we didn't know how the recreational allocation was going to come out. But as it turned out, if you look at the motions coming up,
You have two groups that became the first among equals. They got their best 5 years, and everybody else gets what's left over. And that is wrong. So on that basis alone, I'll make a motion to amend to strike the words after timeline. Basically take out and option five combined.
Is there a second?
Seconded by Rodney. Discussion on the motion to amend? Dr. Pierce?
Well, now we're getting into some parliamentary procedure. If I have another option I favor, and I would move to substitute. I would move to substitute, but before I do that, I need to provide some explanation as to why I'm going to do so. So if you bear with me, Mr. Chairman. I have put a lot of effort into this, as go ahead.
Sorry, but before we have an explanation, I think we need the substitution and,
all right, I'll make
and
a move
second.
I'll make a move to substitute that council approve PSC options 1 and 5. Now, 2 and 5, I'm sorry. 2 and 5. That's a 50-50
yep.
And 5.
Okay, is there a second? Seconded by Mark Gibson on the motion to substitute.
Okay. Now, obviously, I and everyone else has put a lot of effort into this, a lot of thought. What is the best way to go? What is the fairest? What is the most equitable? Paul Diodati, my entire staff, Paul's staff, we've invested heavily in this in terms of trying to do what's best for the Commonwealth and what's best for New England, and, of course, the Mid-Atlantic to some extent. There is no best option, and that was made very clear to us in the public hearing document, in the appendix that was put together by Tom, and I assume other people, that describes the PSC calculations for different types of permits. The numbers are not the way they'll actually be when all is said and done, but it gives you some way to compare the different options. And frankly, after looking at that and the analyses within the document, that there is really nothing there to provide good guidance as to which way we should go. The analyses just don't exist. They are uncertain to the greatest extent for a number of very good reasons. The first good reason being that we don't know who we're going to be in the sectors. We don't know the sector ace. We don't know what the overall TACs are going to be once they're established this fall. But I've got five reasons. Short reasons, Mr. Chairman, so don't panic. Five reasons as to why I think it's important for us to go with option two for the PSC and, of course, option five as well. And some of my reasons have already been noted by individuals in the audience who got to the microphone and expressed their support for the number two. The first one is the very likely tremendous impact of the first option on the inshore vessels, on the small boat fleet. I don't have any analyses before me that I can reference to help me justify to make that point clearly and firmly, because there is none. However, I'm relying on what I heard at public hearings, from testimony, phone calls, meetings with many inshore fishermen whose opinions I value greatly, and they have said very clearly that with option number one, they are truly all done, and they're not blowing smoke. They are truthful, they are sincere, and after further discussion with them, looking at their economic situation, we feel that is true. They will be all done. Another reason why I favor number two, the second option for PSC, is that I want to pick an option that would promote enrollment in sectors. I don't want to see many fishermen in the common pool. I don't want to force people into sectors. That was never our intent. But still, I would like to provide some motivation, some good reasons for individual fishermen to have currency, to be valuable, to be in a position to get into sectors, because after all, they're self-selecting, they're chosen. Well, if you knock on a door and the door is opened, or you're told to go away. So I would like to see these inshore fishermen and others, inshore, offshore, have increased currency for their, well, for their entrance into different sectors to stay out of the common pool, because the common pool will have problems, clearly, and we'll get to that later on today. So that's my second reason, motivation to keep vessels in the common pool. Three, one fisherman already noted this, and I think it's quite true, that many permit holders, they've invested very heavily in additional permits with allocated days at sea, with little to no landings history. Therefore, the options that rely solely on landings history, option one in particular, that will devalue fishermen's investments, and that will provide for great inequity and unfairness, and perhaps to the collapse of those individual operators, loss of homes and the like. I wish I could reference a socioeconomic impact analysis that would show the impact of all of these options so I could compare, because I clearly consider socioeconomic impact to be extremely important in my decision-making process. But there is no analysis to refer to. It's not useful, and that's evident from reading the document. And this is no criticism of those who did the analyses. It just could not be done. So there's nothing to refer to. Number four, the windfall, tremendous windfall of stock, of quota, will go to individuals with landing history if we pick option number one. These stocks are going to rebuild, and they will rebuild, we suspect, in a very timely way. And for those stocks that are rebuilt and still climbing, like Georges Bank Haddock and Gulf of Maine Haddock to some extent, there will be fishermen who will not be able to take advantage of that rebuilding, because we will have provided all of, or the majority of, that rebuilt stock and rebuilding stock to those with the history. So it's a windfall. Someone who caught 1 pound of haddock yesterday will now be entitled to 8 pounds of haddock down the road, as the percentage that they get for a sector is applied to increased biomass. Tremendous windfall. There's also the geographic distribution issue. Fish are going to other areas where they're recovering. Their distributions are changing. The geographical distributions are going back in some cases to the way they used to be, at least somewhat. Cod in the Georgia, in the southern New England, Mid Atlantic area specifically. So that change in stock distribution is my fifth reason as to why I think this option makes a great deal of sense. So those are the reasons why I support option two, and I think perhaps I'll put at the top of the list my desire to provide motivation for fishermen to get out of the common pool and to join sectors.
Someone wishing to speak against the motion of substitute? Terry Stockwell.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm opposed to this motion to substitute for a number of reasons, beginning with the rationale that we just went through for support of option one. There's major support from the majority of the members of the industry and public that we've heard from so far. That being said, there are a couple issues that were just raised that I do have a different point of view on. One is that I don't agree that it will disproportionately impact the smaller coastal vessels. I think, in fact, it will go the other way. If, in fact, they are they have to give away tack on the species that they're most dependent upon, they'll have less revenue to work with. Secondly, Jim Odlin raised a concern about the larger boats coming ashore if they're allocated cod tack that they haven't had in the past. We're looking for incentives for sectors. There are plenty of them, but as we're all coming to terms with, there are very few winners in this process right now. There are a lot of losers. And among those would be those who made significant investments and permits that had a large tax. Those people also mortgaged their boats and their homes. And if those permits were devalued, they're losers there as well. So there's no easy choices here. Of all the hard choices, we collectively, through the committee, and I personally have agonized on them all and have selected option one as the least destructive of all.
In favor? The motion to substitute.
Rodney.
Well, I'm not going to call another against unless I get it in favor. Okay, ready for the question on the motion to substitute. All those in favor, raise your hand. Three. Opposed? Thirteen. Opposed? Abstentions? One abstention. The motion to substitute fails 3-13 with one abstention. So now I think back on Dave's motion to amend. Discussion. Those in favor of the motion to amend. Rodney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm in favor of this motion. I second it because I think it's the only fair way to go. We've been hearing about fair all morning. And what's fair to me is not fair to you. But this is a time series. People have invested. People have bought boats back then. People were in the fishery back to 96. They're still in the fishery. They've paid all the penalties with the rebuilding schemes coming up, and now to disproportionate them people by saying we're going to pick two different time frames, it's very unfair. We're all going to hell. Let's go to hell in the same boat. Thank you.
Against. Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't support this because I do support the option five. I think, in my mind, option five, in fact, is the fairest and most consistent way to do it. And we had some discussion at the committee level, you know, again, about binding the hands of a future council. But by having somebody invest in an alternative and then continually changing that is the least consistent. So I support the concept that you have some operators who invested in the hook sector and the fixed gear sector, and I think we ought to do whatever we can to keep that as consistent as possible. And I say that with whatever decision we make in terms of an allocation scheme going forward. I think we ought to make it and have the intent that we're going to keep that as consistent as possible through the future. So that I don't support this amendment.
In favor of the motion to amend. Other than the maker and the seconder right now. Anyone else in favor? Doug?
Yes, I have been debating this internally because I really agree with Dave that we should be using as a goal having the same time period for allocation. However, I do not want us to set a precedent here as going down the slope of setting a precedent of changing people's allocations that have been made in the past, because I think if we do it here, then we're opening ourselves up to whatever option we use right now. We'll say, well, we did it before. In Amendment 17, we're going to change the allocation process for everybody. I think the only thing that's making this palatable for me to vote against, I'm sorry I'm changing my mind here, is that it only applies to one stock of fish. So at this point, I'm going to vote against it.
Okay. That was neat listening to you think it out. All right. Anyone wish to speak in favor? Okay. You already had a bite, Dave. You want another bite?
Yeah, again, maybe it's the Boy Scout in me. I'm sorry. You can't have separate baselines. It's inherently unfair. You're saying one group of people is better than another group. What's at stake here is not the fact that the baseline... what nobody wants to come to the microphone and tell you is that from 96 to 2001, the baseline for those two existing sectors is far better than it's going to be under any other time period. You're basically saying those people are better off than everybody else. And, you know, people make business decisions every day. A whole bunch of people in this room bought permits with A-days. A-days were the currency. They bought permits with A-days to survive Framework 42. Effective here today, no matter how we vote, based on the way things are going at the moment, those permits are essentially worthless because it turned out when they got their catch history, which they couldn't get till 2 weeks ago, there was nothing there. They had no idea. And yet, you know, they're willing to lump it, like Russell said.
Chairman, excuse me.
You know, they're willing to take their lumps.
I'm going to break in here. You can throw me out if you want. I don't care. But you're going to take this vote. It's going to be conflict of interest in that panel right now. I'm going to lose my life here.
No.
Two permits are going to go out the window. I spent over $300,000, Mr. Chairman.
Joe, you've had a chance. You have had a chance. You told us your story. Go ahead, David.
Well, at any rate, it's just the way it is. There is no 100% perfect way to move forward here. But if we send a signal to the industry today that it's, you know, some people will be treated one way today, and other people will be treated another way today, that there's nothing to stop people from coming in here tomorrow and saying, "Hey, hooray for me, and to hell with you," and. We have to send a message of consistency. I really believe this very strongly. And if we don't, let's just hope we vote this motion up, because if we don't, I got some questions procedurally for the chair.
Ready for the question? All those in favor on the motion to amend, raise your hand. Two. Opposed? Fourteen. Abstentions. One. The motion to amend fails. 2-14-1. Back on the main motion. Yep. Further discussion. Mark.
I believe that the two parts of this motion are very important, but they're unrelated enough to warrant separate consideration. So I'd like to move to split the motion.
There a second? Seconded by Rodney. Discussion? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Four. Opposed? The motion to split fails 4-13. Back on the main motion. Anything further? Do a roll call vote.
Please read the motion and answer yes, no, or abstain. Rodney Avila. Frank Blount.
Yes.
Rip Cunningham.
Yes.
David Pierce.
No.
Jim Fair.
Yes.
David Gafel.
No.
Mike Leary.
Yes.
Sally McGee.
Yes.
Pat Kirkle.
Abstain.
Terry Stockwell.
Yes.
Doug Grout.
Yes.
Jimmy Onlin.
Yes.
Dave Preble.
Yes.
Dana Rice.
Yes.
Mark Alexander.
No.
Mark Gibson.
No.
Mary Beth Tooley.
Yes.
Motion carries.
Okay, we're going to break for lunch. It's 12:30. David?
I just have a procedural question. If I want to file a dissenting opinion with the Secretary of Commerce over a violation of National Standard 4, do I have to notify the council or do I just do it?
I'd have to reference Magnus, and I'll do that over lunch and inform you. Break for lunch. We'll come back at 1:30.